if you don't respect Japanese customs, and if when you take your shoes off, if your sock touches the ground, like the concrete floor,
Yeah.
and then touches the tatami mats, you'll be charged a $100 cleaning
Right,
fee
right.
because you're not respecting the customs, right? So it's like, so clearly,
But
like,
you didn't tell me this. And I walk in and I literally take my shoes off. I'm like, yeah, get your shoes off, blah, blah, and my foot touches there. You go, no, and you're $100. And I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ, like, what am I doing?
I mean, but your sock was touching the outside space, right? So
Right,
you have to touch the inside space.
right. So glad to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We're in Tokyo.
Yep.
This is your home.
This is my home.
And I wanted to start off with this conversation because, I know that the people that know your work know it quite well.
Okay,
And you
yeah.
have like a hardcore base
Yeah,
of
yeah.
people that really follow everything that you do.
Right.
But then there's going to be a lot of people that are watching this be like, who is this guy?
Yeah.
Where did he come from? What does he do?
Right.
So it'd be really cool to hear the kind of backstory and start with, how you ended up here, your career, like a little bit of that would be awesome.
Yeah, the easiest way to start is just like I came when I was 19 to Japan. I was I grew up in the States, and I just had this impulse from a very young age. I was like, I need to move abroad. I need to live somewhere else. And abroad just felt kind of the most natural to me. I grew up in a town that was not, I didn't know it at the time. When you're growing up, you don't kind of understand the context of your town.
Right.
And then I left and I went to, I was lucky enough to be able to go to some good universities, and immediately meeting the people at these universities, it was just abundantly apparent to me how much scarcity we were kind of ensconced in my town. Just financial scarcity and sort of emotional scarcity and all this stuff. So I, from a very young age, also being adopted, I think kind of creates this internal narrative of mythology. You're from somewhere else. You don't know where that other place is. So I just had a really strong impulse to leave, to get out,
Yeah.
because I felt a bigness beyond.
And what was the town again?
I don't want to like name it just because like it just feels bad to. I don't want to like name and shame. Like
But a t like what was the size, the like
it's a
population wise?
50,000 person town.
Okay, small.
Yeah,
Okay.
smallish.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever, you can Google it. I'm sure you can figure it out. But like the point isn't like where the town was, because I think this is a very common narrative of a lot of post-industrial American towns. So the town was like once basically fueled entirely by a airplane engine factory. So
Okay.
it's a huge airplane engine factory that like sort of employed everybody. And then of
By the way,
course.
ChatGPT has just identified your town in 2 seconds. Like, from what you've said so far, it's like, oh, yeah, I got
No,
it.
I mean, anyway. So it's like you have the airplane engine factory, you have a Coca-Cola bottling factory, and you have a Colt gun factory. So there you go. Now you can
Okay.
definitely identify.
Okay.
And what's sort of heartbreaking about it is that, you look at my grandparents' generation, and they had, an abundance of kind of functional baseline sort of financial stability. And they were able to like buy a house easily, and they were able to have a family and all that. And then by the 80s, you sort of had this dismantling of the American industrial town, right? That
Yeah.
started to happen. And so what my town, like now in hindsight, I just realized like, okay, the jobs were disappearing. Things were moving south for tax breaks originally, and then things moved abroad after that. And so there was just this sense of kind of, I don't know, not a super bright horizon that
Yeah.
I felt in this place.
Yeah.
So I, from a very young age, the adoption plus just the impulse to like, okay, I want to, I believe there's a bigger world out there and I want to be part of that. It just had, it seeded this like desire to be abroad.
Yeah.
So when I had a chance, I went to university, and I had a really complicated time there because again, this like coming from the socioeconomic place and then arriving where everyone had been taken care of to such a great degree. It was sort of like, how do I fit into this? How does this
Right.
work? So I started looking at studying abroad, just kind of really almost randomly. I had to take a language course in college, and I didn't want to do any more Spanish, and they had Japanese, so I took Japanese. So I was studying Japanese in college, and I was like, oh, what would it be like to study in Tokyo?
Did you find that easy, by the way, Japanese at
Super easy.
first?
Yeah, yeah,
Really?
yeah, yeah.
Oh my
It
God.
was weird. I think it was just because it was so new. Like you study Spanish and like things kind of sound like English
Yeah.
a little bit, and like it's sort of not that foreign of a thing. But
Yeah.
Japanese was like such a reset, total reset, that it was just fun. It was like a new game. And so learning hiragana, I learned that in a weekend, learned katakana,
In
the
a
next,
weekend, did you?
you can do it. It's
Look,
not that
I katakana in a weekend, there's no way.
yeah, for sure, for sure. You could do it.
There's thousands of
No,
symbols.
it's kanji.
Oh, kanji. Okay,
So
sorry. That's right. It's okay. Okay. Yeah,
The syllabaries. So hiragana, katakana.
Right.
You know, that have like 40 or 50 characters each.
That's right. That's
so,
right.
You know, you just kind of knock those
out. It's when you make the jump to kanji where it's like, those are single.
Yes.
Yeah. Symbols.
Yeah. Logographs.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, no, that's chaos mode.
Yeah.
You know, and computers help with that a lot now. So it's like, it's complicated today. Like if you're studying Japanese today, you're sort of disincentivized to really learn kanji because you can just type phonetically. And as long as you can read, you can write on the computer. It's like, so writing by hand is sort of, even amongst the Japanese, you know, they kind of make a joke about it, but it is sort of a lost art, you know, being able to really write extensively by hand. No, so it was just fun. I don't know. There's just something fun about it, joyful about it. I did really well in the class. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to drop out of school. I'm going to move to Silicon Valley because this is like 99. Mm-hmm. We're talking right now. And I had been doing internships in California. So when I was 13, one of the like kind of wormholes out of my town was IRC. Mm. So, you know, it's 1993. I was programming a little bit. I was kind of teaching myself assembler. Like, this is like what I would do.
Wow. You
know, it's like, because the demo scene was so cool.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know, Future Crew, all those guys. Yeah. I was just like, this is so cool.
Yeah.
And so you're just trying to figure out how to like move registers around.
Right. But that's still hardcore.
It's pretty hardcore. Thankfully, some upperclassmen in high school were like, dude, they came to my house and like dragged me out and like forced me to go to some concerts and stuff, which was good. But you know, I'm on IRC and I was involved with the ANSI art scene.
Mm-hmm.
You,
of course. Yeah. I used the draw.
Yeah,
the draw was like my main tool. I loved ANSI art.
So the draw is like where I started to think about design probably and where I started to kind of I wanted to be a better artist than I was. I wasn't a great artist, but I made a lot of friends on IRC. I was part of Union. I think I may have been in ICE for a second.
Wow. What did ICE stand for again?
Insane Creator Enterprises?
Something like that. So were you into BBSs at all then?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So, because that was a big part of the ANSI scene was BBSs.
Yeah. And I ran like a distribution hub and, you know.
So you were in the where scene?
I can neither confirm nor deny.
Well, I mean, the statute of limitations, I think you're okay now. You're from the 90s. Like Norton or like McAfee or whatever you were like a hawking is like freeware.
That's King's Quest 4.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, for sure. It was just because it was this fun community, right?
Yeah.
It was like
of course.
A bunch of like early teens.
Yeah.
You know, just like whatever, doing goofy stuff. So yeah, I had like famous ANSI artists making, you know, like, you know, they'd make intros for your BBS and stuff.
Of course.
You know, redo the Renegade, you know, file system, the menu system. And so I was doing all that stuff. And so for me, it was like, oh, yeah, the internet. I had a shell account, and then you could do a PPP emulator using like Trumpet Winsock, I think it was called.
That was like a very early stepping into the internet. To get to
use a graphical interface with your shell account.
Right.
I remember using...
Which was challenging.
This was all complicated stuff. And I remember using like, it was Netscape, or not, Mosaic.
Mosaic, for the first
time. And I was just like, oh my, this is it. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is like, in terms of like tools to get out of here, I was like, I just need to know this. That's it. This is my Doraemon door to like go to a different dimension.
Yeah.
And I just committed to it. And so by the end of the 90s, you know, a couple of the ANSI art dudes had started companies in California. So they're like, come on out and be an intern. So I took my beat up Honda Civic and I drove across America four times, which was amazing. So I did that for two summers and kind of had this incredible experience. And I was like, all right, you know, drop out of university. Why be in university? And I looked, but I was like, well, maybe I could study abroad. And I kind of looked at how much universities in Tokyo cost. Mm-hmm. And it was so cheap. it was like an absurdly cheap number for homestay plus the year of studying. And I think meals were included. It was just ridiculous. I was like, okay, why wouldn't I go do that? Yeah. So I just applied on a whim to Waseda independently. Mm-hmm. It wasn't even like through a university or anything. And I got in and I was like, okay.
And you applied in Japanese?
No. This is just English.
Oh, English.
For the international program.
Okay.
So it was like, ended up being a year of, there's probably about 100 of us in the program. Very international. So from all over Europe, all over Asia. I mean, it was amazing. This is what I envisioned / dreamed college would be like. Just like a real socioeconomic mix. Mm-hmm. And just people that were like voracious readers. Everyone was trading books. Mm-hmm. a lot of amazing speakers. A lot of kids came from SOAS in mm-hmm. London, the School of Oriental and Asian Studies, or Oriental and African Studies. And that program is insane. Like, they just really train you well mm-hmm. in language. And so I was like around these guys who could speak really, and I was like, oh my God, this is so inspiring. So it was this life-changing year to come here at 19. Mm-hmm. I'd never really had a drink before. I'd never explored a city before. And to be in Tokyo, and I'd come from this place that, you know, people were struggling kind of around. Like, mm-hmm. you know, sort of everyone, my neighbor, you know, everyone was, a lot of people were alcoholics. You know, I remember one of my neighbors like offered me cocaine, taking me to like a computer fair to go buy a modem.
In Tokyo?
No. This is back in my hometown.
Oh, I was going to say, geez. Yeah, in Tokyo, that's like death sentence.
That would be, yeah.
Well, be pretty hardcore.
Not Singapore, but yeah, you'd go to jail.
Yeah.
It'd be bad.
But for a while, right?
Yeah, like, probably. Yeah. No, this is back in my hometown. So I was like, I was surrounded by people who were struggling. You know, yeah. My other neighbor, he tried to kill himself with like carbon monoxide poisoning.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
The other guy was, you know, just so depressed. A lot of my friends' sisters were getting pregnant as teenagers. Mm-hmm. It just felt like there wasn't this greater good helping. And then I came to Tokyo, and suddenly I'm walking around these neighborhoods. I'm walking through the city every day, passing tens of thousands of people, and it just felt like they were taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And that in the moment, I didn't consciously realize I was feeling that. But looking back now, I realize that healed me in a weird way, and more than anything else about the city. But just to be able to exist here without the violence, without the threat of violence, mm-hmm. without seeing struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't mean people don't struggle in Japan, but I just mean like fundamental struggle about like, is food taken care of? Is shelter taken care of? Like, is education taken care of? Yes or no? You know, and everyone sort of taken care of.
Yeah.
And people dress really well. Mm-hmm. It just felt like it was another level of, it was another realm of sort of existence that they were occupying that I'd never touched before.
Yeah.
You know, because like New York, in San Francisco, late 90s, it was pretty gnarly.
Yeah.
You know,
it still is.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Like, I remember, you know, I'd go out for the summer in my Honda Civic, and like, you know, every morning there'd be a bottle broken on my car, someone pooping on my car. Like, this is in the late 90s. We talk about the poop stuff as being recent. But that's been going on for ages.
No, when I moved to San Francisco in 2000, I was in a little shitty apartment in the Mission, and I would literally, I mean, there was just human feces everywhere.
Yeah.
It was just it was just a thing.
It's,
you know?
It's been it's a classic San Francisco thing.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's been there time immemorial.
Yeah.
In San Francisco. But it was just to go from all that, and those were my, you know, those were my archetypes of how people could live or how cities could function, to then come here at a scale, you know, fundamentally the size of this is like 10 times the size of San Francisco.
Right.
You know, 4 times the size of New York or whatever. I mean, just like, and it just keeps going and going and going. And to not feel that, and you know, even today, there's fewer homeless than there ever have been. But when I got here, there were quite a few, but they all, you know, there were like tent cities set up in the parks, and you know, and everyone left their shoes outside the tent and had like a little like cooking area.
Why is that? Because I've seen a couple homeless in Tokyo, you know, over the years, and I've noticed that like. They purposely, from what I've seen, tucked away in a very clean, discreet, this is my little area, and everything is organized, and I'm like, what? It's the lack of drugs?
Yeah, like, I think it just fundamentally boils down to there's no opioid or meth, heroin situation here. And so, like, when you remove those variables, and basically you have alcoholics, and you have people with mental disabilities, but not zombified.
Yes.
And I think, you know, there is just this cultural impulse to like not bring your shoes in the tent or, I mean, it just kind of makes sense when you start to think about it. And also there is an issue with, I'm postulating, I've never talked to the homeless people at length to find out if this is true or not, but like, I assume there isn't that much of like an issue of stealing stuff.
Right. You know?
So you can leave your shoes outside.
Right.
And no one's going to steal your boots.
Right.
You know, so you can sort of do those things. So even that was just like a shock in that. And then you realize like there were options for these people if they wanted to get help.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying like every homeless person in Tokyo is like choosing to be homeless, but you did realize there were a lot of people that just chose to opt out, like tap out of society.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like, anyway, a different tenor.
Yeah.
Of existence. And all those things together just really, I mean, like I said, healed me. There was something in me that I think growing up where I grew up that was tremendously traumatized by, mm-hmm. by the experience.
Yeah.
And coming to Tokyo at 19, living here 19, 20, that first year, it reconfigured a part of my brain and mm-hmm. just made me hot. And it was so much fun in a lot of ways. It was difficult in many, many ways. It was a struggle in many ways.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it was fun. It was challenging. And kind of getting better at the language was so satisfying.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to go deeper and deeper and deeper. So here we are 25 years later.
Yeah. I mean, so how did... Because you were dabbling in tech, right? So yeah. the logical thing in my mind would have been, okay, stay in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Pursue that as a career. Yeah. Like, you know, post... kind of, you know, you're landing and arriving here in college and in school, what were your options career-wise out here? I mean, you weren't going to be like a salaryman and, you know, like out here.
No. So, okay. So there are several layers. Like one, I've been interested in fiction, novels, writing, for as long as I have memory. So from 8 or 9, I was like really into, I wanted to be a writer. And at the same time, 8 or 9, I also really love video games. So Nintendo was kind of my escape.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for a lot of people, video games are an escape. It's such an incredible palliative. It, you know, you need to burn 3-4 hours. You don't love your life.
Yeah.
Like, here you go. You can have a lot of fun. You can be somewhere else. And so for me as a kid, video games were really important. And that got me into computers because it was cooler video games.
Mm-hmm.
And then that got me into programming because like, shit, if you can make your own video games.
That's yeah, yeah, cool. Yeah.
So that was sort of the progression. And then the tech thing, it was always this... sort of confluence between literature and technology. Like I was really interested. So when I saw the web, it was like perfect because it was like writing and technology and design.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, this is great. And with the BBS stuff, I was hex editing, you know, Renegade to like change the menus and make the design better. So those things were always kind of part of the DNA of interest. So when I came out here, my plan was to just do a year and then I'd go to San Francisco and just no more university, done.
Right.
Why not? Right. It was like, that's where you wanted to be. And when I was out here, the bubble burst.
Mm.
And so it was like, oh, okay, maybe I don't go right now. So I ended up applying to a different university. I ended up going to UPenn because they had one of the only undergraduate degrees that you could do fine arts and computer science,
mm-hmm.
The digital media design program. So around that time, it was like you either had MIT Media Lab,
right,
which was grad only, which was really annoying. But I, you know, John Maida, you know, I just loved the work of these people, you know, mm-hmm. Casey Reyes, Ben Fry, all these people were so inspiring. And Penn had the DMD program. So I was like, all right, let me apply. And like, I wasn't smart enough to get into a school like Penn out of high school. No one from my high school was going to schools like Penn. Mm-hmm. Right. And so it's like, we didn't have guidance counselors. We didn't have people
right.
that knew how to get you into these schools.
Right.
So how to write the essays, who to talk to, how to do the interviews. There was no guidance at all. And, but being in Japan, it gave me this kind of like hack. So I wrote all these like essays about being in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And applied as a transfer student, and I got in. I got into Penn and NYU.
They saw you as a transfer student.
They saw me as a transfer student.
They were like, oh, this isn't just someone randomly applying from the United States. This is an international transfer student that's coming in.
Yeah, like, oh, this guy, wow. Right. He went to,
he's so cultured.
Yeah, he's 20. He's lived in Tokyo. He's writing these like kind of weird essays about Japan and Tokyo and whatnot. And it was fun. And so I got into that program, and I'm the first person in my family to go to university. And so I just felt like I should have probably gone to NYU just because I should have been in New York City. I think that would have been a better place to be in NYU's. But I just couldn't not go to an Ivy. Like that was just like, again, this sort of socioeconomic background situation where you're like, okay, go to the Ivy, you know, and the program was amazing. And Penn ended up being fantastic. I had a great time there. But then as soon as that was done, in the interim, I came out for an internship at a magazine in Tokyo. And that summer, the editor-in-chief said, hey, I'm going to start a little publishing company. Do you want to join as art director? And I was like, sure. And so when I graduated Penn, I just moved back here. I came on a tourist visa, not tourist, but a student visa, again, at Waseda to do post-grad work. And then as I was kind of doing the post-grad work, we were setting up the publishing company. And then once that year ended, we were able to apply for an artist visa. And then I just got an artist visa here. Because I had done a bunch of fine art exhibitions with photography.
Mm.
And so I could kind of say, oh, I exhibited here. And I had all these like photos, black and white photos of like women naked in bathtubs full of milk and stuff, you know? So I submitted those to the visa offices, and they're like, oh, okay, yes, he's an artist.
Yeah, right, right. So like, there's milk involved. It's funky, milk. It's weird.
A naked person in milk has to be a real artist. And so we got that visa, and like, I didn't realize it at the time, but like, that's a really hard visa to get. And once you get the artist visa, it's sort of, you can do anything you want and you can kind of stay as long as you want, as long as you don't murder anyone and you pay your taxes. That's it. And so
is that still the case today?
Yeah, sure.
And how long do those visas last?
Well, they start at 1 year and then you renew and then you get 3 years and then you get 5 years. Mm. And then after 12 years on that visa, I switched to green card, basically permanent residency. But so I went right from university. I didn't like do any job hunting. And Silicon Valley was still a little bit bizarre. This is like 2002, 2003. Mm-hmm. And I loved books so much. And I loved, at that time, McSweeney's was huge. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember McSweeney's.
No, I don't.
McSweeney's, Dave Eggers, he wrote Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius.
Okay.
That was like his big breakout debut memoir novel. Like hilarious, bizarre, super meta. He founded this publishing company called McSweeney's.
Okay.
And they produced, I think it was quarterly, these insanely complicated, like massively designed, over-designed boxes with like playing cards and that, like, so it was just these crazy literary objects, like, because they work with, you know, Michael Chabon and, you know, Zadie Smith, I think, wrote for them early on. Like, they just get these amazing, amazing literary, like, godheads.
In terms of these, like, quarterly kind of, like, was this, like, when Monocle started coming on scene?
This is pre-Monocle.
Okay.
Yeah, like, this is, like, 99, 2000, 2001.
So was Salon a thing back then?
Salon was, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. Salon was like the hipster kind of like website.
Online. Yeah, online version
of that, yeah.
It's funny, yeah. I remember, I have friends who wrote for Salon. I remember reading Salon essays in 2000 and being like, I hope I could write for Salon one day.
Yeah.
I was like, this is so cool.
Yeah, like, Salon had that like reputation.
So
yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, the McSweeney's thing was happening and I just loved the tactility of books. I took a couple of design courses at Penn. And I had one teacher, Sharka Hyland. I had two incredible professors at Penn. Joshua Mosley, who was the head of animation, and he does these incredible, bizarre claymation pieces. And then Sharka Hyland, who was she was this Eastern European woman who like you know, I don't know if she chain smoked or not, but she certainly felt like she chain smoked and would just never say anything nice about anyone's work. She was just like so strict. I loved it.
Yeah.
I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like straight out of like, you know, post-communist
right.
Eastern Europe. Like I grew up eating the worst bread. You don't understand. Your design is horrible. You know, that sort of thing. And she was incredible. And she kind of really shifted my mood around producing physical books. And then the McSweeney stuff was really inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to produce beautiful objects. I just had this like, impulse. And Silicon Valley was kind of on sleep mode.
Right.
Although, if I'd gone there, I think it would have been a good time to have gone there.
2003?
Yeah. 2003, yeah.
Yeah, it would have been, I mean, that's when I, that's when 2004 is when I started my first thing, and that's when things started. Web 2 popping at that moment, yeah.
And I was writing blog software in 98, 99. Because, like, I, you know.
Your own blog software?
Yes, my own blog software.
Okay, so this is pre-everything. What would have been out back then?
Almost
any
nothing.
Blog software? Like, did Ev start?
Blogger was later.
Yeah.
I was in my dorm room, 1998, making a thing called Drool, Direct and Random Observations of Life. That was like the name of it. And it was like Perl scripts, basically, to publish.
Perl scripts. Oh, my God. In CGI bins.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And, you know, I had my O'Reilly books.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay.
Everybody had their O'Reilly books.
It was just for me. I just want to publish, you know.
There was something cool about having all the different animals on your wall.
Again, great book design.
Yeah.
Like, amazing design. And just amazing books. I mean, O'Reilly, it's hard to overestimate the impact that company had on the world.
Yeah.
When you think about it. You know, it's like.
Yeah,
you know,
that and the Dummies books back then.
Remember
the Dummies books?
I always felt that was above the Dummies books.
Every once in a while, I'd like look at one. Maybe I should learn this.
But I the O'Reilly books were like just so wonderful.
Yeah.
I was working on. Yeah, I should have probably gone to Silicon Valley in 2003. We could have met, you know, 20 years earlier.
Yeah, seriously.
It's like, and I ended up doing this independent publishing company with this guy, and we started producing physical books and like doing it at a really high level. First book we did printed in Iceland with this company called Odie. Like, we didn't know what we were doing. And back then, it was hard to produce independent books, to print independent books, because printers had a lot of work, right? Like, now printers are sort of like, they're not hard up, but like the number of books being printed was much higher 30 years ago.
Right.
And so they had all their institutional clients. So if you came to a big printer and said, hey, I want to do 1,000 books, they're like, we don't have time.
Too small a run.
We don't have time for you.
Yeah, because the setup and logistics around setting up that press would be just not worth their time.
No, not worth their time. So we had to go to, you know, this random printer in Iceland who only printed Bibles usually.
Wow. And,
but the, you know, the reason we chose them was because McSweeney's used them.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is, you can kind of cheat. You can look, you know, in all books, they usually say where it's printed, who printed it. And so I, you know, always checking McSweeney's, where are they going? What are they using? And so, oh, Odie. Okay, great. And so ended up going with them. And the book we produce, it's called Kuhaku. You can still buy it. It's on Amazon. It's a bunch of like short essays and fiction pieces about life in Japan, basically.
Is this something you wrote or is it?
No. Okay. I contributed zero words to this.
Okay.
I was the art director.
Okay.
So purely design. And we were just so lucky. The size, it's cloth bound with two color silk screen and one color foil stamp on it.
Mm.
And like, I didn't know what we were doing. And Odie was also like, just willing to take this challenge on.
Mm-hmm.
This is a hard book to make.
Mm-hmm.
And we got it, and it was so beautiful. And we were all just, even in the moment, we didn't realize how lucky we
were. Yeah, but how did you sell that? How did you get distribution for that book?
So that's the thing, is that we didn't have distribution, right?
Right.
And we made too many of them. We made like 5,000 copies, which is an insane first run for an independent press. We had no idea what we were doing. But we went to the biggest distributor in the States, and we sent them the book. And they wrote back to us. They said, look, we never take anyone on that has fewer than like 10 or 20 titles. Your book is so beautiful, we're going to take you. It was like, what?
Did they take, how many of those 5,000 did they take?
A couple thousand.
Okay.
Yeah. But I mean, like, there's still...
But you were underwater at this point, right? Because you're fronting the cost for...
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm not. I'm getting paid an extremely de minimis salary. Like...
Okay.
Like almost nothing. And that's the other reason why. Like, why did I stay in Tokyo? And why did I spend my 20s in Tokyo? The cost of living was just so low.
Mm-hmm.
So I've never in my life spent more than $1,000 on rent. Ever in my life.
That's insane.
Even today, because I'm still renting a house in Kamakura.
Mm-hmm.
And it's $930 for the house. And when I was living in Tokyo, it was like, my rents were like, you know, $500, $600. I basically, the magic of Tokyo was if you had $1,500 a month income, you could live an incredible life. It could be great. You'd live small, but you know, I think living small is a really good crucible, you know. And it's like, I didn't have any savings. I didn't have any, like, there wasn't like, oh, like my parents will bail me out or anything like that. It was just like, I need to keep fixed cost of living as low as possible. Mm-hmm. And there's no way I can do this in San Francisco or New York.
Right.
And I can live in Tokyo. I can have access to all these incredible museums and life, culture, history, and $1,500 is all I have to make.
What do you attribute that to, given that that still somewhat exists today here in Tokyo? And why can't they be pulled and duplicated in other countries?
I mean, I think it's a few things. One is zoning is very loose here. So you can build a lot of different things in a lot of different places. Also, there's just a lot of units. So, and there's a lot of space. Mm-hmm. So like San Francisco, you'd have to...
7x7, you're locked in.
You got to really knock a lot of stuff down and build up. And obviously San Francisco doesn't want to do that.
Right.
Tokyo just goes forever.
Right.
Forever, ever, ever. But the real bizarre thing about it is even in the most central Tony neighborhoods, you can always find, and I think we're just at the end of this, and this used to be so true, you can always find a place for $400 or $500. An old, you know, it'd be like a six mat tatami room.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it didn't have a bath, but around the corner would be the public bath.
Mm-hmm.
You know, up until 80s, 90s, I mean, like an extremely high percentage of the apartments here didn't have baths,
mm-hmm.
didn't have showers.
Yeah.
So the public bath system was really, really used.
Right.
That's disappearing now because everyone has a shower.
Yeah, but it's also the public bath system out here is... That's back to the culture piece. Like everything is so clean and well kept that it doesn't feel awkward or weird to use public baths
mm-hmm.
out here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I've been out in the middle of nowhere and I'm sitting on a little stump with my own little shower nozzle next to eight other naked Japanese men and old men, you know, and we're just all scrubbing and nobody cares. And everyone kind of picks up their nice little, make sure it's clean. And we all walk out and it's beautiful. It's like, it's simple.
Well, and I think it's profound to like to witness all this nudity, you know, because the first time I came and my host family brought me to like an onsen, like it was kind of like a super spa. So it was mm-hmm. like a, it was like a cento, but like with like 15 baths. I was so freaked out, you know, and just the quickness with which like everyone's like ripping off their pants and their right. cocks are flopping around. Yeah, I'm yeah. just like, what the fuck? Like yeah. I'd seen like two dicks in my life, like accidentally, because like I opened the door and my grandfather was getting changed. I was right. like, ah, you know, like forever, you know, kind of scarred yeah. by like the crazy grandfather penis. And you know, yeah. and now I'm surrounded by it. There's like 100 penises all around,
right?
All you know, all different sizes and shapes of bodies.
Yeah, it was an exponential penis for you.
I went from zero to like yeah. yeah, all the penises.
Yeah.
And but it was like you realize that kind of real you know sort of like suppression. That sort of it's sort of like this Catholic guilt of nudity that yeah. we kind of all Americans sort of carry.
Yeah.
Is not healthy.
Right.
You know, it's like, obviously it's not healthy, but to like bear witness to all these naked bodies of all different ages, it's a really profound thing. And then you know, you realize, oh wow, like, okay, I'm not that different, or this isn't different. Like,
right.
Well, you have all these different shapes and sizes. It just changes everything.
Right.
And you become more and more comfortable in nudity. Like I've taken a lot of people on walks in Japan, Americans, and, many of them, you know, we bathe, you know, with groups or whatever, you know, and for most of them, they've never done that before.
Right.
And by the third or fourth day, I've had several people say to me, like, this is the most comfortable I've ever been with my body.
Hmm.
And it's like, it is this, it doesn't take a lot. And
yeah.
it just completely shifts. Nudity isn't something I'm supposed to be ashamed of. And
yes.
like, you can just, no one cares.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. You can be around a bunch of people and like, they just don't care what you look
right.
like. So, you know, part of it is like, you can just build here. Right. So
yeah.
there aren't a lot of zoning mega regulations. That's why, I mean, Tokyo's ugly. Like, there's just no way around it. Like, it's a pretty, like, looking out the window here, it doesn't look like Paris.
Yeah, but the neighborhoods are so cute.
The neighborhoods are cute, for sure.
Yeah.
But on a macro scale.
Oh, yeah. If you look
on a macro scale.
Well, at night, it's beautiful.
Yeah, when you can't see the buildings, it's amazing.
Well, because you see the beautiful lights, and it's just like, yeah. It's
no, I mean, like, it's like, I think it's okay to say this. It's just, it's not a cohesive city. You
know? Yeah.
It's cohesive and it's chaos.
Right.
And, in the result of that is there's just a lot of units.
Yeah.
So, you know, there isn't that much competition.
But at the same time, you don't get housing appreciation then like you would.
You don't at all. So there's no sense of like, oh, I'm buying this thing because it's going to be like a 10% year-over-year investment.
Right.
Sort of. It was like until very recently. So basically from like 1994 until probably like literally 6-7 years ago,
mm-hmm.
the housing prices stayed flat. So it was like 20 plus years of like absolutely no change whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And then in the last few years, in part because of demographic shifts, in part because I think COVID may have accelerated some of it because it made people think about where they want to be more. You are starting to see a little bit of appreciation of
yeah.
land values, which is a very new thing. But the flip side of that too was that like your loan rates would be 0.1%.
Mm.
So you can get a housing loan for 0.1%.
That's insane.
To buy a house. So essentially anyone could buy a house.
Right.
And you could sell it. You know, the house would be worthless. It depreciates. I think a wooden house depreciates to zero in like 20 years,
yeah.
30 years. So the structure is utterly worthless when you sell it, but the land would maintain its value.
Mm-hmm.
And you basically, it was like a break even.
Right.
But you get your own house.
Yeah.
And it's kind of cool to have
yeah.
that policy, the fiscal policy to allow people to get money at 0.1%.
Yeah.
It's pretty awesome. So again, just that sense of being taken care of, even if and I know Americans like would be like, well, but I want to make so much money off of real estate. But like the flip side is that it allows everyone to have something.
Right.
Right. And so like not everyone has to be being able to flip
right.
a house. Right. And then also the other flip side of it is like you can lose your shirt on a house in America.
Right.
Whereas here it's like, that's not really going to happen.
Yeah.
So anyway, pluses and minuses, but I think the real fundamental thing is there's a lot of units.
Yeah. So for you, this was a place of, you didn't really have to worry about getting a Silicon Valley salary because you got low rent. Like you said, $1,000 or less.
Yep.
It's cheap. You're here.
Yep.
You're into publishing.
Yep.
When did you venture and say, okay, like I'm going to take this as my own profession. I'm going to start writing on my own. I mean, I know you were blogging.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
But like, when did people start noticing?
Probably around 2007, 2008. So I super struggled with alcohol throughout my 20s. And I think part of the struggle was being unable to reconcile where I came from with who I wanted to be.
Mm.
And also, you know, Ira Glass talks about like your taste and your capabilities not aligning.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have like this taste, like you aspire to a certain thing and your skills are like down here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't have any mentors. I didn't have any real archetypes. And like, getting myself up to this place felt impossible. It felt like a real impossible task.
And so you're in Japan. You're in your 20s.
Yep. I'm doing the independent publishing.
You had not drank until you were 19.
Yeah.
What was your first experience drinking in Tokyo? Was it in Tokyo that you had your first drinks?
Basically, yeah. I mean, I had had like a beer when I got to college in America.
Right.
Or whatever, but I'd never been like blotto. Yeah, no, it was because the drinking culture was so intense here.
It's super intense.
It's so intense. And I joined the music club at university.
Yeah.
So it was like it was me and like 150 Japanese people. And it was the rock and roll music club. So I'd grown up playing jazz.
Okay.
I was a jazz drummer.
That's awesome.
And I got here and I was like, I want to play punk rock. And because it's like, I just want to do everything that was the opposite of what
yeah.
I was doing. I mean, really, that's, if you look at like Jake Adelstein and like, you know, like Lafcadio Hearn or whatever, you look at a lot of these guys over history, and it's mostly guys who've come here. A big part of it is like this ability to reinvent yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, it's like you can cast off where you came from, who you were, and you can kind of concoct this entire new persona. So for me, it was just like, okay, let me try new things. Let me do punk rock instead of jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys could just drink. I mean, we would get kicked. We would be banned. Every izakaya we went to, we'd be banned from.
Mm.
And then we'd have to find another one. And then right. we'd be banned from that one. And then it was just total chaos.
So were you with, was this just primarily international students or was it other Japanese people?
It was only Japanese people.
Okay.
As part of the music.
So you were just like an outsider. You're like the only white person probably in the crew.
And I spoke like pidgin Japanese. I could barely speak. I was like, it's like.
Is that what they call it? Pidgin Japanese?
No, like just like any kind of pidgin, pidgin language. But like, I couldn't really say anything. But I could play music.
Right.
So we were able to like commune over that. And then I could drink a lot. I found out that I know a little bit more about my genetic history now, but like I intuited that I had a very strong alcohol gene in me and I could have 15, 20 drinks a day.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And not throw up. And I black out. I blacked out a lot. But you know, never got sick. And then, you know, the next day I'd feel like a truck would run me over.
Yeah.
But I could just do that. And I did that a lot from basically 20 to 27.
What pulled you out of that?
I had a really bad breakup. So I was so utterly, madly in love with this person who was this also just tormented in her own ways. And, you know, we met and then basically within like 2 weeks of meeting, we went on a 40-day trip through Tibet.
Oh, this is the yoga instructor.
This is, yes. She was my yoga teacher in Tokyo. She moved to Shanghai. She got divorced and moved to Shanghai. It was like all this complicated stuff, chaos stuff. And then I kind of like, she's like, anytime you want, come out to Shanghai and like we can hang out. And I went to Shanghai and we hung out for the first time and just fell madly in love. And then immediately went on this big trip and da da da. Anyway, I was not in a good place at that time. I was still like very caustic and I was like just lost. And I just felt like, oh, there's something else I need to get to, another place I need to get. I don't know how to get there. And so I'm going to fill that with drinking.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what was the driver emotionally for you to have that next drink? What were you lacking?
So, I mean, I think the question is the first drink. Like, why was I taking that first drink? And the first drink was like, it really was to fill this kind of frustration or this hole, this gaping hole of like, I want to be something. I don't know how to be that thing. I don't know how to do it. I don't know what the steps are. And so I, instead of figuring that out, if I just fill that hole with alcohol, maybe I'd somehow figure it out in that state. I think that was like part of it.
Yeah.
Or maybe I can forget that I'm sad about that state. Mm-hmm. And then by drink three, it was no longer about filling anything. It was just the fucking gene was activated.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, full of energy, buying everyone drinks.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, oh, shot. Oh, you want a shot? You got to do that. Just a totally different person. When I was in England, I have no memory of this. I became someone called Nitro Man, who spoke with a British accent. And
Nitro Man.
Yeah.
You still own that domain?
So, I mean, there was just, I was tormented. You know, it was just a really tormented moment. Time of my life. And anyway, this woman who I was madly in love with and didn't know how to accept love. And we still can be, we're still friends. You know, this is like almost 20 years later now. And she basically left me in that like killed me. Mm. And I remember just lying in my tiny apartment in Tokyo that cost $650 a month and just being like, okay, we need to change something.
Yeah.
There was this real like come to Jesus moment of like, I need to change. And so it was like 3 a.m, I'm lying there insomniatic, and I just went out for a run. I just started running. Just started going on runs. It sounds like a Rich Roll thing or whatever, but it's like, yeah. You know, he's like, I think he has a Genesis story of his like birthday and he's out of shape and he goes and he runs like 60 miles.
Yeah, like a Forrest Gump moment, like just you started running.
I didn't run 60 miles. I ran like, you know, 5K or whatever.
Yeah.
And I started training for a marathon. I started to try to find things that would increase my sense of self-worth.
Were you still drinking? Were you dabbling?
I was still dabbling. It took me, so I was like 27. I didn't really stop until about 33. It took me that long to fully get off it. And I, looking back, I now realize that what I was suffering from was a lack of self-worth. Mm. So like my sense of self-worth was just in the pits. Mm. And by doing the running, you know, starting to run and starting to accomplish these weird little goals. And I was lucky in my 20s. Like I was programming, I was doing these like data visualization projects that were getting a lot of attention. I was invited to be a judge at the Art Directors Club when I was 24. I got invited to be a fellow at Fabrica in up near Venice, mm-hmm. The Benetton-funded art collective thing. So, like, it's not like I was in this complete like
functional alcoholic,
basically functional, but also like I was having success, but like it wasn't in any way making me feel like I had value for whatever reason. I don't know how to break that down. So I started doing the running, and that started increasing my self-worth. And then I started charging more for my work. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, what if I charge this hourly rate instead? And, you know, I was able to do like a technical job, web stuff or whatever for like 2 weeks, and that would cover 6 months of life.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. Wow. Just because it was like the delta between. And then you asked like, when did I start doing the writing and commit to that? I quit music cold turkey. So I was playing, I was in clubs playing 2 or 3 times a week. I was in the studio all the time. I was playing with a couple different bands. And around the same time, I just felt like I need to just get away from all this stuff that isn't serious. Mm-hmm. And the music, I was taking it seriously, but like, you know, I was surrounded by people who really weren't at the same level. And I had been blogging and I was like, let me just commit to this thing. Mm-hmm. And so after the breakup and all the chaos, I ended up going to Nepal on my own and climbing up to Annapurna Base Camp. And I ended up hiring a guide. I was going to do it alone. I ended up hiring a guide at the last second. And it was this incredible, profound experience. And I right before I left, I bought this camera, the GF1, Panasonic GF1. And it was a Micro Four Thirds. It was like one of the first Micro Four Thirds. It was this tiny, it was so tiny, pancake lens. And I brought that up the mountain and I was just like, this is so fun to shoot with. And I came back down and I wrote an essay. It was sort of the first, I don't know if this is the first field report for a camera. Mm-hmm. It has to be one of the first.
Yeah.
Because, you know, now it's like, what's his name? Austin Mann. I think he does his iPhone field. He goes to like Africa and like shoots lions and stuff with the iPhone. But like, this is, you know, 2009-ish. And I did this huge essay reviewing the camera, but doing it in the context of climbing up to Annapurna. Mm-hmm. And it just went bonkers. And I made like in Amazon affiliates sort of money.
Oh, because you were linking to the affiliate of the camera.
And I made like $20,000-$30,000.
Oh my God.
In a couple months. And I was like, this is like, I can live for how many years can I live on?
Yeah.
Like, it was just this crazy moment. And people really responded to the writing a little bit. It just like, it was the design, the photography, and the writing all together on kind of a beautiful webpage.
Right.
So, you know, remember Jason Santa Maria, like that era of web design?
Yes, yes.
Where people do beautiful typography. And
yeah, what was it? There was Six Apart was big back then. You remember Six Apart?
Six Apart, Movable Type, Zeldman. It was like Zeldman. Santa Maria, the Kujal guys were sort of doing a lot of beautiful design stuff. So it was kind of that, being inspired by that, those archetypes of web typography, and then applying that to kind of this field report.
Yeah.
Plus a technical thing. Plus decent photographs, plus decent writing.
Perfect timing. I mean, that was just like all of your best abilities came together to create this moment.
It was bizarre. It changed. Yeah. That changed my life. So I basically went from this terrible breakup and drinking like a maniac to running marathons and committing to writing. That said, I was still, like I said, I was still sort of having drinking things, issues yeah. going on. And then I went up to Annapurna. I came down, and the last night I had in Kathmandu, I blacked out. I drank so much, and I woke up with a huge gash on my head. I'd fallen into the pavement, and just, and like people carried me up to my room.
Holy
and,
shit.
Yeah. I mean, so just, bad things were still,
yeah.
I was still fighting the demons of, it wasn't like a total black and white yeah. moment of flipping, but little by little, I was kind of crawling out of the space.
What was the, today we had so many books to turn to like kind of like go inward mm-hmm. and figure out, you know, what are my issues? Like we've got, you know, the Esther Perels, we've got all these like different great, you know, it's podcasts too, you know, to go into this stuff.
Sure.
You had mentioned, you had a little snippet there earlier where you said that your girlfriend, you weren't willing to accept her love.
Yeah, yeah.
When was the moment that you realized that you were worthy of love? And was that a self-taught thing, or was that something that you learned somewhere? Like, how did you flip that?
It took a while. It took a long time. And it actually sort of just happened recently. Like I'd say in the last like 5 years.
Wow.
So my late 30s was when really, you know, and this is the thing, is like it takes a long time to mm-hmm. reprogram. Mm-hmm. To get over these decisions and myths we self-mythologize as a kid, these stories we tell ourselves about who we are or what we're valued at.
You think that was because of being adopted, ultimately? Like
for sure, that's part of it.
Yeah.
But also, like the parents who adopted me got divorced immediately, so there was always a brokenness to things.
Yes,
and my mom had boyfriends, but the boyfriends, you never knew, can I consider them a dad? Mm. And they'd kind of do dad-like things for me, and then they disappear.
Mm.
You know, and it was always like, oh, okay, I'm the thing that can be thrown away.
Mm.
And no one explains to me why, or, you know, that, I think for kids, like, your role as a parent is, like, basically just make them feel like you're there for them. That's it. That's kind of like 99% of parenting. Mm-hmm. It's like, a stable psychic sense of, like, being there for them. And you just looking back at my childhood, there just wasn't a lot of that. And so
that must have been so hard to date.
Oh, it was impossible.
How do you? Yeah, I had a lot of this too, actually, because my parents were both great parents, but my dad was a horrible husband.
Yeah.
And so I never had a model for what a good relationship looked like.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so dating when I was younger, it was just like, I never really wanted to commit to anything.
Yeah.
I was just like bouncing around, and I was like, you're getting too close to me. Like, what do I do? How do I handle intimacy?
Yeah.
It's a hard thing to figure out.
Well, and it's hard for people that have had great models of parents who, for them, it's so easy to enter into a fully committed relationship.
Right.
To even understand that mindset that we're talking about right now.
Right.
I think in the same way that it's like, for me, to accept love was like asking me to fart myself to the moon. It's like, I don't know how to fart myself to the moon.
That's challenging.
How can I accept?
I've never even heard. Is that like a Japanese saying? Or
this is a Craig saying. But I just, you know, it was impossible. It's like saying, just be 7'3" tomorrow. It's
right.
Like, I can't be 7'3".
Right.
That's the thing with like psychological stuff, is that it's immaterial.
Right.
So people just think, oh, you can easily kind of reconfigure it.
Right.
But that's not the case.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of work. So yeah, it took me a while. I mean, it wasn't until really I had my ex and her daughter, who I was in the daughter's life since she was two, and basically became like the only father figure in her life. And it was only through that relationship with my stepdaughter that through her I saw reflected back at me my value.
Mm.
It was very surreal. And wow. I remember I had all these experiences with my stepdaughter where I thought she was going to throw me away. She's going to throw me away. We'd have like a weird little fight or something. And I'd be like, oh my gosh, she's going to throw me away. And like, it was just insane. This pathology.
Wow.
Of thinking that this 8-year-old was going to throw me
away. She was probably thinking the same thing. Yeah,
exactly. And then I realized that. And then I realized I'd never seen reconciliation. And,
yes.
And I started having these.
Repair is so hard for me still to this day.
If you
haven't seen it growing up.
If it hasn't been modeled, it's almost impossible.
Yeah.
And, you know, my parents never reconciled anything. It was always burning the bridges, and there was no conversation. And so with my stepdaughter, it's like, you know, you'd have these weird little fights and she would just like not talk to me for like a week.
Mm-hmm.
And it would kill me. Mm-hmm. It would kill me and kill me. And I'd be like, oh my God, she's just going to throw me. I'm like, I'm not. This is, you know, and you say this and it just sounds insane. It's like the definition of insanity. Like, obviously you're a value to this person.
Right.
I couldn't see that. And then we had several of these cycles of like little fights. And then I began to see how nourishing the reconciliation was and how desperate she was to reconcile.
Mm.
And in through that, I just thought, oh my God, I really am so valuable to this kid. And like, and then I started to see how I could positively affect her life in terms of like school and thinking about the future.
Yeah.
And I'm adopted and she doesn't know her birth father at all. And so, you know, we would camp on the balcony of our apartment, put set up a little tent and be out there kind of looking at the stars. And we just talk about dads. Mm-hmm. Like, and I'd say, oh, you can ask me anything you want to know about. Like, how do you feel about the fact that you've never met your birth father? You know, mm-hmm. I've never met my birth father either.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she would be able to.
Oh my God. You guys must be so tight still. Yeah.
Pretty tight. Yeah. I mean, I just took her to school in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. So she's 15 now. And it was just me and her. I brought her to, she's going to go to school, international school, because she wanted to kind of learn, get fluent English. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, New Zealand's kind of a fun country.
Yeah.
You know, and feels like pretty safe.
That's going to be a good, clean environment. Yeah. Yeah.
And so we found a kind of cool school for her to go to. And, you know, we went down together and it was like this father-daughter trip, and to go there for like parent orientation day and like meet the other parents and like watch her, you know, go off with the kids. And it was like, it was all very moving. So,
yeah.
I mean, she's sort of that in that like teenager mode of like not really wanting to share tons. But we've had really...
But this will come back, right?
For sure.
In 10 years, there'll be a bond like you've never seen.
I hope so. Yeah.
You have to imagine.
Yeah.
Because those moments, those looking up at the stars, those intimate conversations, like those won't be forgotten.
No. But we've had, we've had really deep, you know, intense conversations. And like, I've also done things with her, I think, that were, in hindsight, like pretty good. Like we really want to destigmatize getting your period. So like, I would ask her, like, you know, starting age 12, 13-ish,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'd be like, hey, did it come yet? Did it come yet? You know, like, just basically trying to, like, destigmatize. So, like, if you do get your period, it's not this thing to be freaked out about.
Right.
And, like, and when she got it, she came running out of her bedroom with her bloody underwear. She goes, I got it! And she showed me.
Oh, my God.
It's just like, I was like, okay, I think we may have, like, over-indexed for, like, it's like, you want to be a little, like, not quite showing off your bloody underwear to, but like, I'm probably the only dad in Japan that their daughter's ever shown their period underwear to, you know? And like, and so that felt good to kind of like be able to enter that space of I think this wasn't just like a mom thing to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And like those boundaries were blurred in terms of who you could talk to about what.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, all those experiences were what really made me believe I had value in the end.
Mm-hmm.
So getting a good salary, accomplishing things physically, those help. But it was really this relationship with I don't call her my stepdaughter, I call her my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
This relationship with my daughter that pushed things to another level.
And then when did, so along parallel tracking this, you're building a career as a writer.
Yeah.
And was it that moment of that first camera review that you said, okay, I'm going to go start producing more content for the web?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that was just such... Like you said, it was this moment of confluence of like all these skills I've been building up, you know, the tech skills, the design skills, the writing, the photography over the last, you know, up until that point, basically almost 20 years,
mm-hmm.
you know, like since I was like 8. And that piece did really well. And then a couple months later, the iPad was announced.
Mm.
And I wrote this book because like, you know, I've been producing these beautiful physical books. And I wrote this this essay called Books in the Age of the iPad. And I wrote it, you know, I'd spend weeks and weeks and weeks on these things, designing it, making all the graphics, infographics, all this stuff, photographing books, and like, you know, setting it up. And I, you know, Japan, we're on the flip side of the time zones. And I published it. It was like 10 p.m. at night or whatever. So like 8 in the morning in New York. And I published it and I went to bed. And I woke up the next morning and my inbox was just like hundreds of emails. And Nick, why am I blanking on his last name? Bilton.
Bilton, yes. Yes. Nick Bilton, of course.
Nick Bilton, who was like the impresario of tech writing for the Times in the late 2000s.
He still writes for the Times, right? No.
He's been gone for ages.
Oh, he has. Okay.
He's like in Hollywood doing some other stuff.
Yeah. He got married too.
I think so.
Like a couple of years ago.
He overcame the inability to accept love as we did.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
I have no idea if he could accept love or not. But he very graciously wrote this sort of caustically titled piece called Physical Book Designer Says Goodbye to Paper. And that was his op-ed.
Mm.
And he, like, it was just quoting my whole article. And so it was just like, it went nuclear.
Yeah.
It just went bananas. And that was like, I think January, February, 2010. And then South by Southwest, the only time I've ever gone was that year.
Yeah.
And I went to South by Southwest and it was just this insanity of like, everyone had read these pieces. And it was just like connections. My those two pieces changed my life.
And what did you start, like, how did you hold on to that audience? So did you have like a newsletter at that point or?
So it was mainly funneling people to Twitter account. That was like the main thing.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I started the newsletter, I think like maybe 8 months later.
Okay.
And then that became the focus.
Okay.
Just everyone go to the newsletter.
And were these just a couple individual long form pieces that you put together? Or had you already started weaving in kind of some Japanese narrative around your experiences out here?
No, I was sort of categorically against writing about Japan.
Oh, interesting.
I think a couple of reasons. One, I didn't want to be Japan guy. Like, I just didn't want to be Japan guy. And
that changed a bit.
I still don't think of myself as Japan guy, but I guess I've become Japan guy to a certain degree. But I didn't want to be a Japan guy. Also, I didn't feel like I like earned the right to be this like third party interpreter of the country, or like something felt icky about it to me. And thank God I waited.
You didn't want to write tourism books then.
I didn't want. I know.
So that was kind of like, because that would have been the easy path. Like,
sure,
you know. And but it seems to me that at least the stuff I've read of you, it's much deeper than that, which I really love, because it was. It was the first time where I was like, oh, like this is the Japan that I wanted to see through in writing, right? Not to like open up the guide, you should check out this place,
right,
and it's
right.
blah, 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 blah. It's like there was more culture beneath your writing, which I thought was beautiful.
Oh, that's great to hear. That was the intent. It was sort of like only at the point where I felt like I had to write about Japan stuff that I started. It wasn't because I wanted to. It was like, okay, I've kind of gotten to the point now where I should probably write about this. And
help me splice in the timeline here,
yeah.
So we get it all together. So when did you start hiking Japan at the same time, or walking? I mean, we've got your first 5K run.
Yeah.
So that was done. Clearly you're starting.
Yeah.
What's the timeline look like?
So around 2013.
Okay.
So there's a chunk we're sort of fast forwarding over, which is 2010. After South by Southwest,
yes.
When I got connected to Silicon Valley, so I ended up going back because my dream was always to be out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was like this childhood dream that I never manifested fully. And so I had this opportunity. Marcos Westcamp was at Flipboard.
Mm-hmm.
Flipboard was like this secret hotness that was going to launch for the iPad.
Yes, the news app for the iPad. Yes,
yes. And
which it got a lot of press and attention for a good.
It was the first
couple of years.
It was the first app that had a waiting list. Remember, because
yeah.
the service couldn't handle the people.
That's right,
and you had to like be in a waiting anyway. Marcos invited me out. He said, Craig, you got to come out. Work with Mike McHugh. You'll learn so much. Like, just come out and do this. And it was like publishing, and I'd kind of had a cachet from my essays. And I went out there and I did that. And I lived in Palo Alto for 3 years, basically. And that was also, again, talk about self-worth, elevating self-worth. I lived with two amazing guys a block away from Steve Jobs. Old Palo Alto. Again, rent was $1,000. So, you know, it was
That's not the case.
No, it's not the case. It was $3,000 for the house, and we just split it three ways. And these guys were so, so lovely. I mean, they were 6 years younger than me. They're Stanford D school grads, but they were just so focused. They're such hard workers. One was a documentary filmmaker. The other was Enrique Allen, who passed away recently, actually, suddenly from colon cancer. And he was involved with kind of design funding and stuff like that. And these guys, like, they just clearly came from such loving families and good places.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably one of the most important years of my life, 2010. Going out there, they didn't drink, they were vegetarian. our refrigerator basically had kombucha, hummus, and LSD. That was all that was in the fridge. We had no furniture. It was like really
what a diet.
Yeah, it was this really special place, special moment. But working with the Flipboard people too was life changing. Just to work with people at that level.
Yeah.
And Mike McHugh was really, really kind to me, and he did weekly meetings with me and like helped me understand how everything was functioning. But I got that out of my system. That was really important. Mm-hmm. That's actually an important thing to have gotten out of my system. I did the startup thing, and then I thought about starting my own thing, and then I realized like all the things I love about startups, you don't do as a founder, right? So you're like raising money all the time.
Right.
You're dealing with HR problems.
Right.
You're doing hiring. You're not actually very rarely building anything.
Yeah.
So I was
like, sucks. After about 20 people, yeah, it starts getting really hard.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, I kind of flushed that like childhood dream. I didn't flush it. I actualized it. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, great. And at the same time, I got a McDowell Fellowship. So I was writing all these essays while I was at Flipboard. Every weekend I would, first of all, I was getting paid more in a month than I made in 2 years. Right. So it was just insane. I think I was getting like $30,000 a month at Flipboard.
Which, wow.
Yeah. I just negotiated hard.
Yeah.
I was like, here's my rate.
You know, were you writing for them as well? Or like, what was
not at all. No, okay. So just, I was there as a, basically like employee number. I was like 8 or 9.
Were you just like a senior PM? Were you doing code or what was
design?
Just
me and Marcos.
So you did the design for Flipboard?
Marcos Westcamp did the design for Flipboard. And then I was like gently nudging and doing typography.
Yeah.
Marcos
is beautiful. App.
Marcos owned that. I was sort of running the iPhone version. That was the project like I kind of was one of the leads on.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was involved with it heavily, and you know, kind of me and this other engineer Troy would do all these sessions trying to put it together. But that, you know, that was an important transformative period. But at the same time, I was maniacally writing. Like, so every weekend when I wasn't in the office, we were working a lot, I would get a hotel room in San Francisco, often like the Mandarin Oriental or something. I would just get like a nice hotel room, and I would go Friday night, and I would get a late checkout on Sunday, and I would literally not leave the room, and I would just write. I'd force myself to write essays up in this hotel room about the future of publishing and digital books and stuff like that. So while I was at Flipboard, I continued to publish. And then at the end of 2011, I applied on a whim to McDowell, which is the oldest writing residency in America.
Mm-hmm.
Really hard to get into.
Yeah.
I got in. And then that was my like transition moment of like, okay, I'm going to be a serious writer now.
Mm-hmm.
And I quit Flipboard, which made everyone really upset. I was like one of the first people to quit. And I was, you know, I was doing good work. It was like, you know, it was a big loss, I think. And I went to McDowell, and I spent a month out in these cabins writing, surrounded by these like, you know, Booker finalists and National Book Award winners and like, you know, playwrights and just these incredible people. And again, leveling up, that's, I can deal with this level of people. And so
how did that round out your thinking? Like, what did that add to your kind of toolkit that you had already had? Because you were already a pretty established writer, obviously. But
it was like, I was established as like a nonfiction essayist.
Yes.
And I was writing pure fiction when I was at McDowell.
Mm.
So I was writing this auto fiction about, my dad had died the year before, and I went to bury him alone. Everyone in the family was dead except for him, and I was like the only living kind of relative. And he had moved into the woods. He kind of lived in the woods alone. And I had to go to this house. I didn't really know this town. I didn't know. And like bury this guy and figure it out. And he didn't have much money. He didn't have much of anything. And it was this really, really moving, profound experience. Like all these sort of, so I was like, I need to write about this. And I wrote about it in kind of a fictionalized way. And so that really shifted me, almost like back to my roots of like what I loved when I was 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, like a lot of the novels, reading, Stephen King was like a huge influence on me when I was young, but also like Sandra Cisneros, like The House on Mango Street.
Mm-hmm.
I remember reading The House on Mango Street when I was a teenager and just being like, even though it was about this sort of immigrant, I don't know, she's Mexican. I think she might be Mexican. Yeah, it's an immigrant family experience. The voice of that book, though, I just felt it speak to me so strongly.
Yeah.
It was so beautiful, and I was like, oh my God, you can do this with literature. And so going to McDowell and being surrounded by all these amazing fiction writers, I kind of went back to that place. So that really seeded, I think, what you said you were responding to in my writing about Japan.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of that began at that residency. Mm-hmm. And then I've been nurturing that since.
Yeah. What was the big kind of breakout moment for you in terms of, well, I mean, you at some point you connected you know, what you were doing in terms of these walks, and like how did your traversing Japan come into the mix?
So I moved back to Japan in 2013, and I sort of don't have a purpose. I'm like, why am I here? It's like I lived in, the Bay Area, and there was something about, it was like really expensive. I was looking to move to San Francisco. I was like, well, I'm going to pay $3,000 a month for this apartment I don't like and a place I don't really love. What am I doing? So I ended up just coming back to Tokyo. I kept my place in Tokyo the whole time. I was just kind of like, I was renting it to a friend most of the time. And I came back and I was just like, what is my purpose? Like, I don't want to work for a Japanese company. I speak the language. I kind of know the culture in the country. And then I met this older gentleman. He's 20 years older than me, Australian guy. I made this book called Art Space Tokyo when I was like 28, 29. And he was involved with the art world, this guy, John. And we connected over that book. A mutual friend said, oh, you guys should know each other. We sat down for breakfast when I was like 29, maybe 28, 29. We sat down for breakfast at 10 a.m. and we didn't stand up till 4 p.m. Just like talk.
Yeah.
Just this like instant like melding. And we kept in touch. And, he came to Japan when he was like 17, basically, on a scholarship. He went to Japanese university, studied in Japanese, classical, he can write, everything. And when he was 19, 20, he started walking the old roads because he was studying the literature and he wanted to know what the literature, he wanted to experience firsthand what the literature was talking about. So you have the Tokaido, the Nakasendo, you have the 88 temples on Shikoku, you have Okuno Hosomichi, Basho, Matsuo Basho's route up north. And he, 18, 19, 20, 21, walked all of it. And he has this really...
Basho's route, the haiku... Poet?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So the road to the narrow north. Okay. The narrow road to the north. So going up, up through Sendai and kind of then along the Japan Sea coast. And so John's history is really fascinating. Long story short, he's like 34, and Rupert Murdoch asks him to be the CEO of Sky TV in Japan. Mm. So John is the CEO launching the first satellite cable news network in Japan. So he's just this baller dude.
Yeah.
Right. And he basically does 10 years of that, and he's like completely burnt out, and he retires at 44. And then it takes him like another, basically like 10 years to kind of recover from that. And he's an incredible academic, and he decided to just recommit himself to going back to the old roads and studying again. And he started inviting me on these walks, and most of them were on the Kii Peninsula, so the Kumano Kodo. And I didn't know anything about any of this stuff. So 2013, the timing was perfect. I'd just gotten back from Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. I felt my sense of self-worth and my relationship to the city totally reconfigured. Like this was actually a really profound thing to come back. It was like it was almost like the hero's journey.
Yeah.
I had left. I had been successful. I had played that hand in Silicon Valley. I couldn't have played it any better.
Mm-hmm.
I had this war chest of money because I was spending $0.
Right.
My burn rate in Palo Alto was like $1,500 a month still. Mm. It was like, I didn't spend any money. I was able to come back and it just felt like, oh, I had done the thing. I'd achieved this incredible thing that I'd always wanted to and hoped to. And so I was in this place of like, what's next? What can I do next? Mm-hmm. And John started inviting me on these walks and we travel really well together. And we just started doing more and more of them. And I just started to watch John, who has this the most beautiful fluency in the language. He's studied tea ceremony for 40 years.
Mm.
And tea ceremony is very formal in the language.
Oh, geez, so many steps. 50, it's a lot of stuff. Like,
well, and the full ceremonies are like 6-7 hours long.
Yeah.
Cooking and you're serving and it's like all the, and there's tobacco involved and all this stuff. And watching him, we'd be in the middle of the countryside, watching him interact with the farmers and the innkeepers and draw on this kind of imperial level Japanese. And watching how moved everyone was and how friendly everyone became, he became this true archetype of like how you could be in the world with kindness and respect and elevation through language.
Mm.
And, we spent months together, months and months and months walking together.
Mm-hmm.
Every year in the spring and the fall, we do another month of walking together. We do this trip together.
When you say a month of walking, is that... Because, when I think about a walk, it's like a buddy invites me out to go for a half hour. and also, but let's clarify what old road means. Like, are we talking like brush where you're like trying to get through? We're talking
no bushwhacking.
Yeah. So what's
going on? No. So it's here? Like, so you have different levels of these old roads, right?
Yeah.
So come on, the Kii Peninsula is very lush. There's an insane fecundity there. Koya-san is there. So it's in kind of the middle of the peninsula, mm-hmm. Koya-san, the Shingon Buddhist sect main area. That is sort of mountain roots. So you're kind of like going up and down mountains.
Mm-hmm.
You're not bushwhacking. They're well-established roots that have been around for 1,200 years. But you are kind of going up and down mountains. So those are sort of like that. The coastal roots are a little more relaxed on the peninsula because mm-hmm. some mountains, but not quite as intense. But you're going village to village, basically. And you're staying at inns. So you're not camping. We're never camping, mm-hmm. really. Sometimes you camp.
And are you welcome at these inns?
Yeah.
But was it confusing? It must have been, because there wasn't probably a lot of Westerners that were doing this at the time.
Not tons. But Kamanokoro had been UNESCO World Heritage designated.
Okay.
And so that happened in the mid-2000s.
Okay.
And it was sort of picking up steam by the early 2010s.
And how welcoming are folks, generally speaking, in Japan?
Super welcoming. Yeah. And again, I think welcoming, to be able to be welcoming means you have, there's this word in Japanese called yoyu. And it basically means an abundance of space in your heart to like accept challenge or friction.
Mm.
So it's like, you just have this, like you aren't stressed about things. Mm-hmm. So like if a stranger appears, you're not stressed about how am I going to deal with this? Because mm-hmm. you're taken care of. There's a certain amount of taking careness, like the foundation is there.
Ooh,
for you to be kind.
Have you written an essay on this? Yo-yo?
It's in my next book.
I need to read this. I'm so excited.
So it's in the book that's coming out May 6th.
That's awesome.
Things Become Other Things. That's the book. There's a whole chapter on yo-yo. And so I think because Japan, generally people are taken care of, people aren't struggling existentially,
mm-hmm.
they can be kind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just it's possible. So no, everyone was really, really generous to us.
But there's also like this in tell me if this is the same. So I first came here, my first time in Tokyo was 2006, I want to say. And it was very, I mean, first of all, it just blows your mind as a young person.
Sure,
you're just
sure.
like, where am I? And this is the most awesome thing in the world,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And then it was just like, back then I didn't have like an iPhone or anything. And so I had a map, like a physical map. And I remember an old Japanese man walked up to me and was like literally just doing his best to try and make sure I made it to where I needed to go.
Yeah.
And it was like, and I'm so conditioned to be like, is this person going to rob me?
For sure.
Like, are they going to take my wallet? For what's going on? And there is none of that.
Yeah.
And it was just like this, like, sense of we're all in this together.
Yeah.
That I had never experienced in any other culture.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
It's pretty beautiful. It's changing now because of over-tourism. Like, that experience you had would be much more difficult to find today.
I've noticed that when you enter into a, what's changed for me, and I've probably been to Tokyo maybe, I don't know, 20 times now. What's changed for me over the years is that now it's kind of like this first, like, 2 minutes of, like, who are you when you enter our place?
How much of a pain in the ass are you
going to be? Are you going to be a bro Westerner?
Yeah.
Or are you going to show up with a little bit of respect and dignity and not be a loud person?
Yeah.
And if you can just know how to enter, and it's the very subtle little things about how you might have a small space for, and it's like, it changes everything.
Yeah.
But it's that little signal that you have to show. Am I getting that right? Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's totally about little signals. And the problem is now just with so many tourists coming who don't know of those signals and also kind of don't care.
Yes, they're at.
That's shifted. But the countryside is still the countryside.
Okay.
And no one's, where I'm going, like, there's almost no one else going.
Yeah.
So people are very accepting. But yeah, Tokyo, it is interesting to think about how Tokyo has changed demographically, but also in terms of tourists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, when I came here in 2000, in the moment, you didn't realize how special it was, but it was basically almost like Edo period. You know, it's like there were so few tourists.
Yeah.
So you were getting this really unfiltered, real experience. And then around 2011, 2012, the tourism bump became real.
Mm-hmm.
China was the real catalyst. So it's like, you know, it wasn't Western European or American tourists mm-hmm. that really kind of shifted things. It was China, who had this middle class of hundreds of millions of people who could suddenly travel that has flooded, I think, like Paris, London, Tokyo. Like,
what did they love about Japan?
it's 2 feet away, and it's clean, and you can trust the products. So a lot of Chinese just come with giant suitcases and go to the pharmacies and just like load up on diapers and cleansing products.
More domestic made products.
Japan made in Japan.
Because now sadly it's flipped the other way, where a lot of Japanese products, at least on the electronics front, are now manufactured in China.
Right. So yeah. It was this, you know, like early 2010s, you had this entirely new middle class of travel capable people who were coming. You could come, you know, from Shanghai, you can come to Tokyo for the weekend. So it was like really transactional. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, you know, if you look at the gross numbers of like tourists, you know, Chinese, Korean, Thai, so basically Asia in general outnumbers Europe, America, almost like 10 to 1.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just really different scale.
Yeah.
So it was sort of this different tenor of tourists who were coming for some cultural things, but also transactional things. Mm-hmm. And then for some reason, like Japan just reappeared on everyone's map. So you were getting more Americans, mm-hmm. we're getting more mm-hmm. Westerners, Western Europeans. And so people had to close up. They had less yoyu. Mm-hmm. If you have 15, you know, white families coming into your shop every day that don't know what they're doing,
right,
causing a ruckus,
yeah,
expecting this, getting this,
yeah,
being annoyed, writing bad reviews,
yeah,
you know, it's like you shut down, you lose that yo-yo.
Tell them about our lunch with the shoes the other day.
Yeah, that was pretty shocking, but that's 100% like a result of this. It's like, so we went to this little cafe in Yanaka. Yanaka is like, it's on the tourist maps, but it's not on the tourist bus maps. Like, mm-hmm. you won't get a tour bus dropping people right. off. But you get kind of adventurous. It's mostly like on the white person map of things. Like you Western travelers. It's mm-hmm. like you see a lot of like kind of lost Western families sort of roaming Yanaka. Mm-hmm. And it's an amazing area. I've been going to Yanaka for 25 years. I love it. It's the one part of the city that wasn't firebombed during World War II. Mm-hmm. GHQ is going to use Tokyo University as their headquarters if they invaded. And so the mandate was don't firebomb Tokyo University. And by not firebombing Tokyo University, you created this like penumbra of safety above it. And that's kind of where Yanaka is. Mm. So it's got this old vibe to it. It's special, lots of temples, all these things. So anyway, we're walking around there and we go to this cafe, and before we're even like letting the door, the woman like has this like weird English explanation.
Right.
She, you know, I'm speaking to her in like fluent Japanese. And she has this weird English explanation paper that's like, says, if you don't respect Japanese customs, it was like kind of, it was totally crazy language. If you don't respect Japanese customs, and if, when you take your shoes off, if your sock touches the ground, like the concrete floor,
yeah.
and then touches the tatami mats, you'll be charged $100 cleaning
right.
fee.
Right.
Because you're not respecting the customs, right? So it's like, so clearly, like.
But you didn't tell me this. And I walk in and I literally take my shoes off. I'm like, yeah, get your shoes off, blah, blah. And my foot touches it. You go, and you're $100. And I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ, like, what am I doing? Like,
I mean, yeah, because it's like, because people like Westerners, we don't think about, again, it's the small details. It's
yeah,
like,
I was okay. taking my shoes yeah. off. I was starting to do the thing.
But your sock was touching the outside space.
Right.
Right. So you have to touch the inside space.
Right.
And they were like very
adamant. That's a balancing act too, because I'm kind of like trying to sit on one leg.
And also, like, they didn't really have any room for you to take your shoes off. Like, it was kind of weird. Anyway, but like that is clearly because they've had just dozens, hundreds of people show up and take their shoes off and then just like walk outside in their socks and come back.
Right.
It just drove them insane.
Right.
And like, you just realize these people are up against the wall with being frustrated.
Right.
And then the most hilarious thing was we go into the back tatami room and it's the ugliest, most dirty tatami
right.
I've ever seen in my life. It was like, can I pay you to replace these actually?
Right.
Like, I'm happy to give you $100.
They're hoping for someone to touch the mat so they can get a good cleaning done.
That's their business model. Yeah.
Yeah.
That actually wasn't a warning. It was a request. It was like, please walk on the concrete and then touch the tatami.
Yeah, so we could. Exactly.
I mean, it was just so weird, but that is a thing you would not have seen 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And definitely not 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're doing these walks. You know, at what point does that start to integrate into your writings and then into your following, and how did that grow from there?
I started writing about them in the newsletters kind of lightly. And Kevin Kelly was a friend. We mm-hmm. met while I was at Flipboard. I was also doing, I think that year I was at Flipboard, I did like 10 conferences, like giving talks at conferences. Mm-hmm. I was so overextended.
And he started Wired magazine, for those who don't know.
Kevin Kelly started Wired in the 90s. He was co-founder of Wired in the 90s, kind of chief editor for a while. And he saw me giving a talk, and he emailed me from the audience. And I got off stage and I was like, I got this email from Kevin. He said, oh, I like what you were saying. Like, I have questions about tools, you know? I was like, and I do not come from a place of knowing, right? So I'm like really embarrassed. Like, I didn't know who Marshall McLuhan was when I started talking about like media theory. I didn't know who Kevin Kelly was when I moved out to Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. I didn't know when I started walking with John, the real difference between a temple and a shrine. I kind of didn't know. Temples are Buddhist, shrines are Shinto. Mm-hmm. I kind of didn't like, I didn't think about any of these things. So like there's huge parts of my brain. And again, this is a lack of mentors, a lack of kind of being shown paths to knowledge. You know, I think mm-hmm. that people overestimate how having like someone in your life to just be like, hey, you should read this or look at this. I didn't have any of that. And so I was like, who the hell is Kevin Kelly? You know, like everyone should know Kevin Kelly in Silicon Valley. And a friend was like, dude, you got to meet Kevin. So I met Kevin. He was this tiny guy with an Amish beard. And he's like, oh, what tools should I be using to publish? And I was like, oh, this guy's kind of sweet.
Yeah.
And we started doing walks in Pacifica together and talking about tools. And then he saw I was doing these walks in Japan. He said, hey, I'm going to come out for a conference. I'd love to walk for like 4 days. And so that was the first time I walked with someone that wasn't John.
Mm-hmm.
And we had these amazing conversations. And I realized I could really unlock the countryside for people.
Mm-hmm.
And, I could talk to everyone. I could facilitate conversations. And like, I wasn't a guide. I wasn't being a guide. We were walking as friends.
Right.
He didn't hire me to be his guide.
Right.
And it was just kind of a moving thing. And we were like, this is cool. We should invite someone else and like do a walk together. So we invited Hugh Howey out and we did Kumano Kodo. And I was like, oh, this is really cool. Let me invite photographer Dan Rubin out and we'll do like 8 days and then we'll make a book immediately. Like we'll make it, 8 days of walking, photographing, mm-hmm. two photographers like doing this route. It was like 100 kilometers or something in the mountains. And then we hid in this farmhouse for a week. And I had a printer Amazoned over and we just like printed out all of our photos and like sequenced a book and did it in a week. And then kickstarted it. It did really well.
Which book was this?
This is Koya Bound.
Okay.
It was just like really slapped together.
Is this the one that, Matt Mullenweg was gifting out your books a lot.
Yeah, that was.
And that's how I first heard about you, I think, was when Matt Mullenweg, who created WordPress, was gifting out your book.
And Matt was with Dan and me.
Okay.
And it was
that explains
it. It was right when I think Matt's father was about to pass. It was this weird moment. Like both, I think Dan had just lost his dad.
Yeah.
Matt's father was sick. And so it was kind of this special walk for all of us, you know, to really just sit with life and talk about life. And I mean, it was really moving and cool. And, you know, Dan and I photographed and then we did that book. And so I was like, okay, there's something about this walking, the talking, whether it's with people or not, or just alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I started doing solo walks then too, because I felt like I'd learned enough from John to be able to start to do these things. I built up the confidence. This is 2016. Mm-hmm. So I walked with John for 3 years before I took anyone else on a walk.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to do 3 years. I'd done 1,000, 2,000 kilometers mm-hmm. with John before I was like, okay, I feel like I can kind of do this now. And that Koya Bound book was like this reminding me, oh, that's right. I love making books.
Mm-hmm.
I'd kind of forgotten because the Art Space Tokyo book was like 2008. And then Koya Bound was 2016. So
how many did you sell of that book?
It was 1,000. You just mm-hmm. limited run, 1,000, you know, knock it out.
Did they become collectible or something? I thought they were like went up in price or something. There was like, because they sold out, right?
They sold
like,
out. Yeah, yeah, you can't get it. I mean, it's sort of like, I'm not embarrassed by the book, but I'm not like super, I'm not like, you should definitely check that out. I mean, it's just photos. It's it's like a little essay I wrote in the beginning and then just, it's just a photo book.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at the photos now and it's like the eye of someone for whom all this is really new.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just interesting to see what we were looking at mm-hmm. and what we were being drawn to,
mm-hmm.
Which I'm now not drawn to at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like this completely different reconfigure. So it's a nice historical moment of my walking sort of instilled in a photo book. But after that was when I really started to think more about writing about it in newsletters. Or even Kevin and I started organizing bigger walk and talks around mm-hmm. the world. We did Spain, China, Thailand, England. We just did Bali last year. We did England again last year.
No, you and I went on the London.
Yeah, you were on the Cotswolds walk.
Yeah,
And so walking and connecting with people just became like integrated with my life.
Who came up with the idea? Because one of the things that Kevin Kelly, there was like a document PDF that he had about you know the at some point you guys formalized what. Were the best aspects of the walk and talk. And one of the things that I thought was just very unique and quite fun was that Every person in the group comes up with a question for that night.
Yeah.
And then around the table, you all discuss that question. So it's a unified topic, and it could be pretty much anything.
Anything, sure.
Yeah. And so what was the impetus behind that? And
well, that's just called a Jeffersonian dinner. So it's like a norm of doing dinner conversations. So Jeffersonian dinner is one topic, one conversation.
Yeah.
So you don't have like, and everyone kind of, it's
best. But as selected by one person for that one dinner, does that fall within that definition?
I think.
Because that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
You couldn't change. It wasn't like people bouncing around. Oftentimes you get off topic. You know?
Yeah.
And I love the fact that it was like, just let's dig into this.
Yeah. Well, it was just the nature of like, you know, you have 7-8 people and we have 7 days.
Yeah.
So like every day someone can pick a topic.
Yeah.
And then it kind of works because of the gravitas of Kevin. It's like everyone abides by the rules.
Yeah.
I think if Kevin wasn't there, it wouldn't be quite as cohesive.
Right. Yeah.
Like Kevin.
He likes to keep shit on track.
Oh, he's like off topic.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's like one conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
If you start chatting on the side,
yeah.
You got in trouble.
A couple times.
You were pushing his buttons. But yeah, no, it's like if Kevin isn't there, Kevin kind of really makes it work as a elder.
Yeah.
The wise elder. But no, I mean, those walks have been really transformative for me, just to meet all these incredible people and to be able to invite people I love.
Yeah.
And to spend a week as an adult with someone you love who you may be good friends with, but you don't spend a week together.
Yes.
And it's just great. It's a great framework.
But the vulnerability that comes out of that is also quite impressive. For some, I don't know what it is that creates that space, but like it was like instantly everyone just kind of let down their guard and was just able to be like, very intimate, personal things are shared in those walk and talks.
Yeah. Well, it's because we murder a hobo together. The first time.
That was so you can't talk about that. So it's like,
so once you share
this blood-bound, like oath.
Just one hobo.
Exactly.
That's the magic trick.
So it kicks it off. Yeah.
No, but it is true. I mean, I think part of it is the trust in Kevin and me of who we've chosen. And then also, like, I try to set the tone. Like, I try to be as radically vulnerable without being annoying as possible.
Yeah.
And I think like if one person sort of does that in a way that it feels permission giving.
Yes.
And so like that's sort of, and by the end, I mean, we've had just total sob fests on the last night, you know, like some of the walks were just like, like unbelievable sobbing of just like, you know, emoting. I mean, these crazy therapy session and stuff. Which is funny because Kevin isn't really like an emotional crying guy. And so Kevin, you know, is kind of sitting there watching people sob and he's just kind of like, okay, this is interesting.
Yeah.
Everyone's being emotional. Interesting.
Yeah.
You know? And we're all like, oh, I love you.
Yeah.
I love you too. Oh my God. You know? So, and no, they're incredible. But then, you know, the walks, I think that the stuff that you've read of mine, probably most extensively are like walks I'm doing alone.
Yeah. Yeah. So
not in a group.
And what, you have this kind of like secret club situation, like, you know, but you've done this really interesting, like there's, when you think about how people monetize their creative work, we've seen everything from, you know, ad-based models, obviously old school, to like, let's get as many page views as possible, to more, you know, Substack models where it's like smaller, but paid per month. And then, somewhere in between hybrids where they're selling something and they also have a gear shop or whatever, or Uncrate models where this is what I carry, and, you know, like affiliate sales. Where did you land? And cause you do these board meetings, you do these, like, how did you come up with this, and what is it? So you can tell people that aren't familiar with what you've created.
Oh, it was out of total desperation. So it was not some, sort of like pre-calculated plan. It was total desperation and total improv jazz. So I started a membership program in 2019. It's called Special Projects. And I started it because I had spent in 2018 and 2017, 2018, I had been working on these huge essays about walking in Japan. I'd done this big walk up in Yamagata near Dewa Sanzan, Rokujuri Goi Kaido. And I was writing about that. I was trying to write about the Shinto Buddhist sort of syncretism, and I was writing about the history. And like, to me, this was like kind of a walking opus sort of thing that I wanted to get published. And I was talking with an Atlantic editor, and we were going back and forth, and he was like, yes, okay, we'll take it. You know, we commissioned this thing. And he goes to me, and he just totally goes to me. And I wasn't able to get the essay to this place that they would publish.
Mm.
And it killed me. And I didn't know what to do. And again, I was hitting this, this taste and skill gap. And I was hitting this ceiling. And I was like, I don't know how to get to the next level. And at the same time, the editor in chief of Wired, he was at Wired, he's now at the Atlantic, emailed me or messaged me and said, hey, why don't you write about like where the future of digital books is today? Because I had lectured, so I had this like sub thing of like, I lectured at Yale for 10 years, 2010 to 2019.
Mm-hmm.
I'd lecture in the summers at the Yale publishing course. I'd be lecturing about basically the state of digital books, mm-hmm. design, digital design, stuff like that. And so I was sort of known to kind of like comment on these things. He said, write about, where digital books are today and like kind of how disappointed we are and da, da, da.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did. But what part of what I was writing about was about this sort of weird new thing of membership programs, kind mm-hmm. of having a renaissance,
mm-hmm.
Because they'd always sort of existed in some way or another. But there was Patreon and mm-hmm. Kickstarter was sort of part of that. And then Memberful was another little thing. And I wrote
OnlyFans.
OnlyFans, big one.
Which many people don't know your side account, but there's good money to be made there.
Hey, I've got I'm not going to hit that $1,500 a month alone on walking, and so I wrote about that. And in writing about that, I was like, maybe I should just it's like I know what I want to write about. I was having this existential crisis. I did calls with all my friends who were journalists. I said, should I move to America? Should I go work at a magazine to like learn how to be a better magazine person or whatever? And everyone to a T was like, dude, you have an audience.
Mm-hmm.
Like at that time, my newsletter it wasn't a billion subscribers, but it was like 10,000 strong subscribers, which was a lot, whatever.
But like dedicated.
Super
your
dedicated.
Your open rates and your emails were probably pretty high.
Super dedicated. I knew exactly what I wanted to write about. And they're like, you are where we want to be
mm-hmm.
in terms of a beat and mm-hmm. independence and all this stuff.
But also just like this sense of like, I feel like when I first started checking out your stuff, I was like, this is a person that I aspire to emotionally get to in terms of like, I want to live a simpler life. And there's something beautiful about working so hard in a tech startup, doing all my shit, doing the grind and then reading this and being like a mini vacation via your work, And so I was like, oh God, how do I get his job? So do you feel like people were like reading it and saying like, oh, I want to go on these trips. I want to do these walks. I want to do these. Like it was kind of an aspirational kind of situation.
I guess so. Yeah. Well, I mean,
especially for Japanophiles, for people that were Japan curious.
Again, I was like really lucky that I'm in Japan. But I ended up coming to Japan. People just are interested in it. It's got this aura to it.
Yes.
So it's easy. It's catnip for people to read stuff. But I launched, the membership program without really a plan and without any kind of like bonuses or benefits. I was just
what was your price point on that?
It was 10. I had like a micro tier, $3 a month and like a $10 a month and like $100 a year.
Mm-hmm.
I
think,
were my things.
Mm-hmm.
And I launched and I felt like such a loser and such a failure because I wasn't publishing with The Atlantic. I was launching a membership program and I didn't think the conversion was going to be that good. And it wasn't, I like didn't get that many people signing up for it. Like I did okay,
mm-hmm.
but I was like,
covered your rent.
Barely.
Barely.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't that much of a like mega hit right off. I had to fight for every subscriber.
Like what was the tipping point then? Because like, obviously it's done so well now.
Yeah. Like, now it's doing great. Like now we're totally in like safety zone. Like it's just like, it's this incredible machine that just allows me to explore all these things that whatever I want to explore. The tipping point was, so 2019 I launched it and then I had to get over the ego hit of not that many people joining it and get over the fucking, the frustration of like having to bang that drum all the time,
mm-hmm.
like and like the shame of it. I'm running this program. Please join. Like there was a lot of shame kind of connected with that. But then it flipped. I launched in January, and then by the end of March, something had flipped. And I said, okay, there aren't that many people, but look, here's a bunch of people paying me money. It's not like an insane amount of money. I could, it's like whatever, it's fine. But I'm going to take this as permission to go do a weird big thing that I never. And so I had never done like a 40-day walk before. John and I, we'd walk together for 30 days, but it'd be like 10 days here, 5 days here,
right,
over the course of a couple months.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, I'm going to do one of these big mega walks that John had done when he was like 18.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to set up I actually built with Josh Miller of Arc Browser.
Oh, God, yeah.
So like Josh.
Are you an Arc Browser fan?
Nah, I mean, I appreciate it, but I'm...
I do too. I want to be so bad because yeah. it's such the hipster cool browser.
I just use Chrome.
I know. Yeah, so do
I. It's fine. It's fine.
I know, but I gotta...
It's fine. I yeah. can't. But John, anyway, Josh yeah. Miller and I were doing a call and I was saying, hey, I'm going to go do this walk. And I was thinking, I want to do this SMS publishing project where mm-hmm. like instead of sending updates to email, we'd send to people's SMS, like, you know,
right.
inboxes. And
Twitter used to function that way, by the
Twitter
way.
Twitter used to be, yeah,
it
totally
used SMS, to get an yeah. SMS. Yeah.
And so Josh was like, okay, I'll build that for you. I was like, okay, cool. And so like his team built it and they...
It was like pre-Twilio or whatever. You couldn't like just fire.
No, it was using Twilio.
Oh, was it?
I think, okay. yeah.
You could have done it yourself.
I could have, but like, yeah. I don't know. ChatGPT wasn't around. It would take too much effort. So he built that. And so I did this walk. I walked from Kamakura to Tokyo and then Tokyo to Kyoto over the course of, it was basically 30 days. And I had never done anything like that before in my life, that degree of mm-hmm. distance. I'm photographing every day. I'm talking to people every day I'm writing a little, just a paragraph, mm-hmm. like an SMS snippet and sending a photo. And I was on the back end, you could respond. I wouldn't see any of the responses. And then what we did was we collated all the responses. And then I handed off the data file of the responses and my little messages and photos mm-hmm. to a designer. Mm-hmm. And they put together a blurb print on demand book. And then, so I wouldn't see any of the responses in real time. The idea was to be as in the moment as possible and not to be doing any back and forth. No communication. I just wanted to be in the moment, in the walk, seeing the people, talking to the people alone.
Because in some sense, if you would have seen those responses, they would have helped like shape, it would tainted the purity of the moment for you.
I mean, it just changes what you do and focus on it.
The next day you'd be like, oh, they didn't like the way I said that. Like, I might do this differently.
Yeah, and you start to crave, oh my God, I got fewer responses today than yesterday, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I didn't want any of that. And I was like, okay, it would be really cool. So we do this and then it's handed off to this designer. I don't see it. And then I only see it as a blurb print on demand book that arrives at my house when I get back from the walk.
Wow. And that's so cool.
It was amazing to come home and to have this book and to like go back through the walk. And I saw my little paragraph I wrote every day, the photo of the day, and just hundreds and hundreds and every day.
These
little messages of like beautiful little responses. Some people send photos.
And how did that do on demand wise? Did a lot of people buy that?
Just one book.
Oh, it's just for you?
Just for me.
So you never put that out for anyone else?
No, it's just for me.
Oh, interesting.
Because there's like, you know, like people were like confessing like really intimate
stuff.
Oh,
yeah. And you don't have all the rights for the...
Well, I pitched it as like, this is just for me. So people could be intimate.
Yeah.
And, you know, people were like, you know, my mother just died yesterday and your walk is like moving me.
Oh my God, that's beautiful.
To get your update every day and to feel like I'm out there with you like means so much right now and da da da. So that was a pretty transformative moment.
Yeah. What a crazy idea. Yeah. Where do you come up with these ideas? That's like, that's pretty awesome.
Desperation.
Well, you also did this other thing too. And I know we're jumping around here, but didn't you do this thing where you were just like recording Japan with no narration? Like it was just like these moments.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I started doing just binaural recordings.
I remember like tuning in and I was like watching like, just like people like walking around and stuff and like some little random street or something. And I was like, why am I just, I just want to sit here and watch this for like forever.
Right.
Like what was the thinking behind that?
I mean, just like anti-influencer.
Yeah.
It's like, how can you do the thing that is not the thing that the algorithms want you to do?
Yeah.
But also I started doing binaural field recordings. So I just, you know, so that walk was so successful. I did the Nakasendo. And then I started doing more and I wanted to add more and more layers of media without it being overwhelming because mm-hmm. I wanted the points to be focused and attentive. But adding a binaural little recording thing. So like there are mics you put in your ears mm-hmm. and you can record high quality onto a little Sony recorder and it sounds like 3D. So SW945 is the podcast I made of these binaural recordings.
So I'm a little confused. So you put these things in your ears.
Yeah.
And are they microphones?
They're mics, yeah. So they're mics that sit in your ears. And so when you then listen to the recording back, it feels like you're in the space. It's super 3D.
It's almost like Apple Spatial Audio.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so you have a device that you're wearing with you, and then people can
walk
with you?
No. I would stop every day at 9:45 in the morning, wherever I was, sort of. I was kind of loose with it. I would stop, and I would do 5-minute recording. And that was it.
Okay.
So, because I'd be in the middle of nowhere. I'd be in these weird parts of the country.
Right,
no one was walking.
Right.
You know, you walk the old Tokaido, the old Nakasendo. Nobody was walking most of it. And so I'd be in front of a pachinko parlor. So great. Right. I'd go into a pachinko parlor and I'd sit in the corner and everyone would be like, who the fuck's this guy? You know, I was the first white person to ever go into this.
But you wouldn't say anything.
I wouldn't say anything. And I just put it in. I'd sit there.
And like, these are mics in the ear.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Mics in the ear. So
I gotta buy these.
It looks like I'm listening to something. It doesn't look like I'm recording.
Right.
So I just walk in. I look like probably a suicide bomber or something. You know, this kind of weird guy who's not talking anymore. He just sits
in the
corner.
Playing the machines?
No. Just sitting. Sitting on a couch.
That's super creepy.
And the smoking couch or whatever.
Yeah.
And I just go in. I'd sit there and I'd be like, okay, I hope no one bugs me. And I just record for 5 minutes. But I do, you know, I'd be in a cafe or I'd be on the side of the road.
Yeah.
And it was just this way of creating like an ethnographic kind of audio profile of the walk.
Yes.
And then I said, oh, okay, well, this is fun, but why don't I just bring a nice video camera?
Yes.
And just wherever I am at that moment, plop it down.
And this is what I was watching.
This is what you were watching.
Yes.
And so I started doing that. And there's hundreds of these videos.
I was actually, when I watched it, I was like, damn it. Like, I was mad that you discovered something that I should have thought of, because that's my jam. Like, right. I love, you know, I heard about this slow TV movement a while ago.
Right.
You know, where people watch people knit and shit.
Right, right.
You know what I'm talking about?
Right.
And they, like, put it on late at night.
Sure.
And, like, literally people will watch people just knit for, like, hours on it. And apparently it's really popular programming.
Right, right.
And I was like, this is brilliant because it's, I don't know why my soul craves that type of material.
Well, I think like part of it is that you're just in a place that you would never be.
Yes.
It's not Googleable.
And it's not telling you a story. It's just like letting you observe something that would have been a moment that would have disappeared without you knowing.
Yeah. And for me, it was about cultivating like an intense sense of mindfulness of that moment.
Yes.
So I love doing them because it was like you'd stop, you'd set it up, you'd frame, and then you just stand there.
But you purposely didn't pick, in my mind, and correct me if I'm wrong here, it wasn't like you were trying to pick an interesting moment.
No.
Which is what I loved about it, because the social media person would have gone and said, oh, here's the crazy spot in Tokyo where somebody's going to walk by in a crazy outfit. And like, you know, but and yours was like, I remember there was some kind of cow or some shit in one of them. There was something where I was just like, what am I watching? But I love it. I'm like so into this.
Well, and like, I'm so under optimized. Like I could probably have like way more subscribers and more, way more, you know,
no, but members. It's the right type of people.
That's all I want. And I think this is important as someone, you know, if you're thinking about doing a program or whatever, like thinking about your scale.
Yes.
So what scale are you operating at that like is sustainable and makes you feel good? And then again, you're just optimizing for quality over quantity.
Right.
You know, and I feel really lucky. Like my members are fiercely supportive.
Yes.
And they totally get what I'm doing and they encourage it.
Okay, so back to the membership.
Yeah.
All of this is behind a paywall.
No. So the membership program didn't really have a paywall for anything for the first
time. Well, because I didn't see those videos behind a paywall.
No.
Yeah, so.
So the whole point of the membership was to be like NPR. So everything.
Oh, just you're a supporting member.
Just supporting me to produce this stuff, and I want it to be available for all.
But now you do these board meetings behind a paywall.
Right, but those are. So basically, in 2019, I was figuring things out. 2020 COVID hits and I was like, okay, what do? We can't go anywhere. We're stuck in Japan. So I was like, okay, let me make a book. Cause I really, really loved making that one-off book.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was like, I need to do more of this.
Yeah,
like, why am I not doing more books? And I was like, okay, I'm going to make an incredible book. You know, I'm going to work with a great printer. It's going to be like super dialed in. We have all this time and I'm going to do it about the Kisaten cafes I walked through on that first big walk and the pizza toast I ate. And so I kind of put this thing together. It wasn't very long, maybe 30,000 words, 35,000 words. And, you know, in the middle of the heat of COVID, going to the printers, trying to figure things out. And I launched it in August. And it's $100 a book. And having known my history of working in the industry, I was like, okay, $100 a book. I'll make 1,000 of them. It'll take me like 2 years to sell these. That's the standard. And, you know, I'd been building up and building up. And then we launched the book. And I wanted to be able to give members coupons.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the big insight. This is the big, you know, product market confluence.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to, it was a $100 book, but if you were a yearly member, you got a $40 coupon.
Mm.
And I was like, that feels really good. So it's like the membership is supporting my ability to make this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get most of it back if you buy the object that comes out of it. That felt, I was like, this feels really good. And Kickstarter didn't let you give people coupons.
Mm.
And that drove me nuts. So I started looking at Shopify. And I was like, I think I can make my own Kickstarter. So I made Craigstarter, on Shopify.
That's amazing.
So I programmed like bootleg Kickstarter,
yeah,
which had like tiers and like you could kind of see the thing fill up and there'd be goals. And it was like, I was going to make it no matter what. But, you know, people get motivated by that, yada, yada, yada. It was kind of fun. And we sold out of 1,000 books in 2 days.
Wow.
It was just like, and that was, and the conversion rate for non-members.
Oh, that's me getting kicked out of the room.
Oh, shit. 1220.
Oh. Hello. Good morning. Yeah, I'm just finishing up packing up. Is it possible to get a slightly later checkout? 1 p.m. sounds great. Thank you so much. No, I'm good with the luggage. Yeah, thank you. Alrighty, thank you. Bye-bye. Okay, we're good.
This is the important, this is like the real business insight moment. So the conversion rate for non-members to members buying the book was like 30%, which is insane.
Right.
A 30% conversion rate. So it's like, so people are coming to the page. They're going, oh, I could buy this book for $100. Or I could pay $100 plus $60 more to get the book.
Right.
And become a member and get the book. Right. And they're like, that makes sense.
Right.
And I was like, wow, okay, that's special. Yeah. That's interesting. And that changed everything. And then
Have you read Predictably Irrational at that point?
No.
Have you read it yet?
No.
Oh my God.
Sure.
I mean, it's all about the crazy psychological pricing.
Getting a deal.
Well, I mean, it's like, okay, you get the Best Buy, the electronics ad, right?
Yeah.
They anchor price something really high. And then, you know, all of a sudden that $2,000 TV looks really cheap compared to the $8,000 one. Right. There's all the psychology behind pricing.
About this, like, I just realized, like, first of all, a lot of people wanted to support me, right? And so, but the membership didn't offer actually anything tangible.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have this book, and it's a beautiful book, and it's like beautifully produced, and I had done all this kind of behind the scenes stuff. So people knew what they were getting, and they were excited about it. And I realized, like, oh, okay, people really want to be activated to join the membership program, but they want to get something, which is like, whatever, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so I was like, this is it. This is what I do. And so from that moment on, like, my entire life has been reconfigured around, okay, everything is about making books and about that confluence between membership supporting the work that makes the books happen. So
that's amazing.
Yeah.
And tell us, before we get into the new book, tell us about the board meetings.
And the board meetings were just, the first year, because I had so few members, I did like 2 days of Zoom calls a quarter. And you could just slot in when you wanted to talk to me. And I just did one-on-ones with all the members.
Wow.
Yeah. And
that doesn't scale.
That doesn't scale. And I realized, like, and I, like, very quickly, it was like everyone was asking me the same questions. I was like, okay, this is stupid. We should do it like as a group. So then I switched to doing like a group Zoom, but then there ended up being too many people.
And right. They have those hard limits, I think, at 1,000 or something.
And Zoom just sucks.
Yeah.
So then I flipped to unlisted YouTube with chat. Mm-hmm. And that's like perfect.
Right.
And so what I do is, they used to be quarterly. Now they're every 6 months, because that just felt better for everyone. Like, quarterly is too much. And I do a morning call and an evening call to get all the time zones. And we just talk about, what did we do in the last 6 months? What did I accomplish? Reiterating the goals, which are always to make books and to educate. And then, what do the next 6 months look like? What are the goals for the next 6 months? And then I do a Q&A for like anywhere from 45 minutes to like 2 hours. And they ask, members ask amazing questions. So I have this corpus now of these board meeting videos, and that's members only. So I programmed, I built my own, the members only site used to be a .ht password file that everyone had the same password to on my server.
.ht access.
.ht access.
Yeah.
Yeah. .ht access file that was password, that had a password.
Right. Plain text.
Login password. Login was Goonies. The password are good enough.
Right.
That was like, everyone got that.
Yeah.
And so there was like no gatekeeping really or whatever. And then I built a Python membership website tool connected with the Memberful API last year, just kind of as like a fun.
Memberful's great, man.
Memberful's amazing.
Yeah, I don't use it, but people love it.
So good.
Yeah.
So I built that. Now the members only website, actually, when you become a member now, you get access to all the archives of my pop-up blogs, which are like, I think something like 400,000 words.
Yeah.
So there's like books and books and books worth.
Yeah,
So I had a book come out, Kisa by Kisa came out in Japanese recently, and it's done really well. People, I'm getting all these wonderful emails. And one guy wrote this email to me, and he wrote, I am literally vibrating with excitement before your archive of walks on your members'
website. Was this in Japanese or
no, in English?
Wow, that's
Because the Japanese, you'd be like, oh, I forgive the translation problems.
No.
Vibrating is pretty...
I'm vibrating with excitement before your archive.
That's a big fan.
So it's gone from, I've offered, members got nothing to now you have this archive.
Yeah.
All the board meetings, I have like 120 hours of video.
Yeah. I mean, you can drop those into Notebook LM or whatever now and you could have a conversation with those videos.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of fun stuff we can do with AI stuff.
So there's a whole universe of member stuff. But fundamentally, it's about the books, discounts, prints, that sort of thing.
The Pizza Toast video.
Yeah.
Tell me about
the documentary.
That. Yeah, the documentary.
Well, because I didn't think I was going to sell that many books, and I made a bullshit tier where it's like, if we sold 800 in like a day, I'll make a documentary about Pizza Toast.
Yeah.
And we sold 800 in a day.
Yeah.
I was like, fuck, I got to make this documentary now.
It's beautiful.
Thank you. That was really fun to make. Again, that was like in the middle of COVID.
Yes.
There's one Kisa that I'd gone to that the Pizza Toast was like the kind of the best of the whole trip by far, design-wise and presentation-wise. And I went back to him and I was like, hey, can I do a movie about you making pizza? And he was like, what? And I just kind of like twisted his arm until he kind of relented. And we went and photographed this, shot this thing and made this little video, this little documentary without words, just this guy making Pizza Toast. And it's done really well. I mean, but 40,000-50,000 views on YouTube or whatever. But like, I went back a year later and to show him because we weren't in communication at all. And I went back and he goes, oh my God, I thought you hated it. And like, I was terrible and you couldn't use it. I was sure you just threw it away. And I was like, no, let me show you. And I was like, it was hundreds of comments. And I like play the video for him and he's like crying.
Oh my God.
Cause I'm like, he's just been doing this for 40 years. He's never thought about it.
Yeah.
And it's like here again, this idea of value, your value being reflected back to yourself. And he's like crying. I'm reading all the comments, translating the comments for him. And he's like, oh my God, I never thought about any of this way. And so it was really moving. It was great. This great thing to come out of that. But unexpected.
There's a point where now when you mention things, like it's kind of blowing spots up, right? Like,
a little bit, yeah.
How does that feel? Or does that feel a little bit... Because in some sense, like you're kind of... If it gets too big, then you'll be kind of like, king making / ruining the thing,
Know? And I'm very... self-aware of this stuff. So, I mean, the big thing that happened was 2 years ago. 3 years ago, I went on a walk. And again, like the membership program after that first one, and then after the book came together, it was just a flood of permission. Just go do your thing. And so I just started thinking of weirder and weirder things to do. Mm-hmm. So I decided to do this walk where I'd go to 10 mid-sized cities that you'd never go to in Japan. Mm-hmm. And I'd walk 50 kilometers in each city. Mm-hmm. And I just like had to talk. And I'd spend 3 nights, 4 days in each city. So I did Hakodate, Morioka, Sakata, Matsumoto, Tsuruga, Onomichi, Matsuyama, I think, Ehime, Karatsu and Saga, and Kagoshima down, and also Yamaguchi City. And so I went to all these cities, and I did these 50K walks. And I treated it like I did in the countryside. Mm-hmm. I talked to many people, photographed people, do these huge dispatches. By this point, now I developed this practice of, every night I write 2,000-4,000 words. So it was this ascetic practice, really, these walks, photographing all day, being like sort of radically attentive to everything, talking, taking notes, constantly writing, taking notes. Mm. And that night, compiling everything, sending out these big missives. Again, feeding off those messages that were like, hey, this going on this journey with you is really moving. Mm. And instead of it being a paragraph, now it's an essay every night. Mm-hmm. And so I did that. And then The New York Times, I was writing for the New York Times, kind of freelance every now and then. And the editors do this thing called 52 places to visit. They just list every year. And, they ask all the writers, they ask hundreds of people, like, hey, submit a place. And I was like, you know what? The city of Morioka was amazing. And literally no one had ever mentioned it to me in my like 20 years at that point of having lived in Japan. And I was like, I'm going to just push this. I wrote this little essay for them and I was like, this place is amazing. You should totally put it on the list. And I thought it would be number 30 or 40 or 51 or whatever. And the list comes out, this is 2 years ago, 2023, January. And number one is London because the coronation and like the king was changing and stuff. And then number two is Morioka.
Oh my God.
And it was just like.
How big is the city?
It's 300,000 people.
Oh, so it's a good size.
It's not.
So it can handle your rush of New York Times people.
Well, okay, there's a couple things in the calculation. One was it's in Tohoku, so it's up north.
Right.
It's a place that no one goes to normally. Mm-hmm. You really have to want to go there to get there. So it's
Where do you fly into?
You take the Shinkansen up.
Okay.
It's 2.5 hours Shinkansen north from Tokyo. And it's not like it's right next to Kyoto, so you're going to get like the spillover of Kyoto over tourism into it.
Right.
So like, and my idea was like, I just want to get people to Tohoku. If you looked at the tourism numbers, less than 1% of all tourists go to Tohoku in Toto, like all of Tohoku. So I was like, all right, well, if we can get people up to Morioka, hopefully they'll explore Tohoku. And so like, just can we economically kind of support this region a little more? Because it's like, you know, it isn't that Japan gets too many tourists. Actually, on raw numbers, they get not that many tourists compared to London or Italy or France. It's far fewer than Italy. It's like a third the visitors that Italy gets.
But it's probably heavily concentrated.
It's heavily concentrated because Japan's really bad at like promoting things.
Kyoto and Tokyo.
So my idea was like, if we can just like siphon off like 100,000 people a year extra, like to go up north and go, that's like huge. Like,
well, especially given that it seems like the country is losing cities.
For sure. So that was the other thing too, is like you realize there's a vibrancy to Morioka that was really inspiring. And it made me think about like what makes a great city, what makes for a great life. Like how is great life enabled? And like, why does Morioka feel so rich compared to some of these other countryside cities, which are just disappearing? They're just evaporating. And, you know, a lot of countries around the world are dealing with this aging population, lack of child issue. This is not Japan. Japan's a little accelerated, but Japan is not unique in that. And so looking at these mid-sized cities as bastions of like ways to live a great life that aren't in Tokyo or Osaka, to me, that felt really important to spotlight it. Anyway, Japan went bananas with this. I did 50 TV shows.
Oh my God.
I was on like Good Morning America, Japan. Every newspaper.
Were you getting recognized in the street?
Up in Morioka, people were stopping their cars. Craig, thank you. I'd walk into a bar. Everyone would stand up and start clapping.
No way.
Yeah. It was insane. Like everyone wanted to buy me drinks and like, you know, buy me cakes. And,
yeah. Like,
get me
I don't drink anymore.
Yeah. It was like really awkward. Like all these like Guinnesses were arriving and like, it was bananas. I went up, you know, after the piece came out, I went up to meet the mayor. I thought I was just like going to go meet him one-on-one.
Yeah.
They walked me into this room. It's got like 40 reporters. It was like paparazzi, machine gun, you know, and like, I'm like, hadn't prepared a speech or anything, you know?
Yeah.
And like, I'm sitting with the mayor and like, we shake hands and it's just like a freaking wall of video cameras and like, you know, huge TV crew people.
Oh my God.
And the mayor gives us like little speech, 2-minute speech. And then he goes, good luck. And he leaves. He just leaves me with all the press.
And are they hitting you with questions?
Yeah. It's like Q&A time.
Yeah.
And like, I don't have any real A's. And like, they were like, Moto-san, how do we solve poverty? And I was like, I'm just a guy who likes coffee. Like,
Yeah.
You guys have really great coffee. Like, everyone here is lovely. The food's amazing. The landscape is beautiful. Iwate-san in the background is gorgeous. The castle park is fantastic. Like, everyone seems to be living a good life here. The history is interesting. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just a cool place. I don't know how to solve poverty. But it catalyzed this thing of Japan, I think, becoming aware of the value of these places. Mm-hmm. But like, this is just a really interesting example of like the membership program having an insanely outsized impact.
Yeah.
So a third party recently calculated the economic impact that it had on the city, and it's basically at $100 million right now.
Oh my God.
So it's like, I think it's much more than that, to be honest, in like psychologically elevating like the sense of, again, how do you feel self-worth and what does that make you do, and making people return and making people want to move there. It's like you're creating generational value, like really durable value.
And when you say return, it's because there is this mass exodus from smaller cities to Tokyo.
Yeah,
right?
Like a lot of Morioka people would like leave, maybe go to university in Tokyo, and then instead of staying in Tokyo, they go back to Morioka. That's sort of like an interesting, like they call it the U-turn. And so just highlighting that and being able to support that, like, you know, that New York Times piece I wrote was 200 words.
Mm-hmm.
Like 200 words resulting in $100 million of impact.
Just insane.
That's going to be the most impact of words I do in my life, I'm sure. And, but you know, I wouldn't have gone there without the membership program giving me the permission to do the weird trip where I'd find these places.
Yeah.
No magazine would have told me, hey, go to 10 random cities and walk 50 kilometers. Yeah. So if you are doing a membership program, do the most strange, radical, uniquely of yourself things you can,
because
that's the whole point of doing it.
No, that's a great point.
If you're just going to do normal stuff, just go work for a company.
Yeah.
Go work for a magazine. being independent and getting that permission is permission to be a little bit wacky.
Yeah.
So, which is important.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, tell us about your new book.
And the new book. So yeah, the new book is called Things Become Other Things. It's about, it takes place during a walk during COVID I did in 2021 on the Key Peninsula, writing a big, you know, set of newsletters while I was doing that. And basically I walk, you know, like 1,000 kilometers or whatever, this peninsula, the old roads during COVID where it's like totally emptied out. Every inn I have to myself. And it was this really bizarre, solo, reflective moment for me. And I just started thinking about, and this wasn't the intent, thinking about this friendship I had as a kid with this this kid, Brian, who was my best friend in elementary school. I'm an only child. I'm adopted. I have no blood sort of connections to people, really. And like, Brian was a brother to me, as close as it could be. And he had older sisters and whatnot. But like, Brian and I were like thick as thieves. And then I tested a little better than he did. And so I got put in like the gifted program, which we had miraculously, that really saved my life in a lot of ways. And then by middle school, we were kind of separated further. And then by high school, he was going to kind of the alternative high school. Mm-hmm. My high school was already bad, like in terms of reputation. And Betsy DeVos called my high school out as the worst high school in America.
Oh, wow.
When she was Trump's education secretary.
Yeah.
Anyway, just, and so he was going to the high school that was like even worse, like for the kids who were bad.
Mm-hmm.
And, we graduated, and like a couple weeks after graduation of high school, he was murdered. And so that, in the moment, I didn't have the yo-yo to process.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I just got to get out of here. Yeah. And actually, his murder was almost like it almost proved to me what I felt intuitively. Mm. Like, I have to leave this place.
Mm.
This is what you get if you stay.
Mm-hmm.
And that really propelled me to get as far away as possible and get to Japan and then feel the healing and then like create as much, live as cheaply as possible to create as much of an economic buffer so I never have to return.
Mm-hmm.
That was definitely all going through my mind. And so I wanted to write about Brian. And I tried to. It was funny. I was going back through my writing files when I was like 18, 19, 20. I was writing up little short snippets of memory about him, mm-hmm. kind of in the House on Mango Street style.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really got far with it. And on this walk, for some reason, like I just started seeing, I'd see like little school kids running around. I just started thinking about him. I started thinking about us and what would it have been like had we been grown up here,
mm-hmm.
which was not too different than where we grew up in the sense socioeconomically. Because, you know, the peninsula is all loggers, fishermen,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's all industry people.
Mm-hmm.
It's all, you know, blue collar farmers, just workers, salt of the earth people. And that's kind of like what our town was. And yet there was none of the violence. There was none of the suffering. There was that yo-yo, that richness.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started thinking more and more and more about that. And that this book, so this book that's coming up with Random House in May, May 6th, is basically this letter to Brian of this walk and all of the characters that meet along the walk, all these amazing people, the farmers and inn owners and cafe owners and fishermen and, you know,
I'm just so excited for this.
Yeah, no, it's you know, obviously it's about this, you know, the death or whatever, but it's meant to be this kind of joyful portrait of elevating all the people that are left. And again, these people are sort of disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's meant to be almost like a anthropological document of this peninsula at this moment in time.
Mm.
So yeah, I'm excited about it.
And you can pre-order it now?
You can pre-order it.
If you become a member.
If you become a member, unfortunately, I
because Random House, I can do the discount. Yeah.
So, but what I can do is if you pre-order it, I have a thing set up where you can email me your pre-order and you will get a $30 coupon to use in my shop.
Oh, that's amazing.
So you basically get the book for free if you buy another book or whatever.
Yeah.
So I figured out a hack to do
that.
Yeah. Using Google scripts.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why did you start smoking?
I started smoking about 2 years ago.
I think this is a very beautiful thing just to like throw out there as something to splice in because it's a meditative practice for you.
I get one a day.
One a day.
And I don't always take it, but I get one a day. I started it 2 years ago because I did this, again, membership funded.
I was like, buying you the cigarettes.
And they're buying me cigarettes.
You're like, might as well spend it on something.
In Japan, it's super cheap. Yeah, it's just like, you know, whiskey and cigarettes. That's where all the membership dues go. But the Japan has the pizza toast places are called Kisaten. And there's kind of a music analog called Jazz Kisa. And, you know, I was a jazz musician. I've been going to Jazz Kisa my whole life in Japan. And they're also disappearing. So we're at the end of the people who grew up during the Showa era, who started businesses during the Showa era, are kind of dying.
Mm-hmm.
And this generation is disappearing, and this generation ran the Jazz Kisa, ran the Kisaten, and you realize there's really like literally like 5 to 10 years left for most of these places. And I, you know, 2 years ago in the summer, I was like, okay, let me do a 20-day mega tour of the best jazz kisa up into the northern part of Japan. And I just did this. And I started going to the, and they're all smoking establishments. Mm-hmm. And I didn't call them. I didn't set things up. I just like show up sight unseen. And what I realized was the easiest way to endear yourself to them was to have a cigarette. Just sit down and have a cigarette. And you're part of the smoker crew. Mm. And it just, there's a subtle little thing, but they opened up more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized like, oh, you know, like actually sitting and having a cigarette and not looking at your phone, like that, that to me is death.
Yeah.
People like, honestly, I think one of the harbingers of doom in the end of society is vaping while frantically TikToking.
Yeah.
Like that to me is like, we're done.
Yeah.
You're like, it's like pure pacifier in every direction.
Right.
You know, it's like, might as well, if you have a diaper on, that's like the next step.
Right.
Right. And so to sit there in a beautiful jazz cafe, to have this music playing through these beautiful JBL speakers, and to have a nice coffee, black coffee, and just have one cigarette is kind of just a gorgeous, beautiful thing.
And you're hand rolling it, you're selecting your tobacco.
At this time, I was just smoking American Spirits.
Okay.
Because I wasn't quite that. Six months later, I got into the hand rolling. But it was just funny how it like connects you to the master, the owner, and it creates this moment of meditation, real awareness. And it turns out that nicotine feels really good.
Yeah.
Like nicotine's amazing, actually. Thankfully, I don't have an addictive angle to it for some reason. Like I feel really good about it, but I really can only handle about one cigarette a day.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really do anything after that. And then I got into the hand rolling and I actually went to this, I was in Nagasaki doing some research about 6 months ago. And I always look around for smoking establishments, places that look like you can smoke, because they're usually the most interesting, to be honest. We've kind of scrubbed society so hard of smoking that the hanger-oners, the hangers-on are truly the most like sort of textural, you're going to get the funkiest conversations.
Well, I just went a couple nights ago to the grandfather's, the bar out here, because they purposely, I mean, he's in his 80s or something.
Yeah.
It basically has a massive record collection.
Yeah.
Pulls out whatever he wants to put on.
Yeah.
You see this old, everybody's smoking.
Yep.
And then they put the record on display for everyone to see.
Yeah.
When they swap it out.
Yep. Yep.
And you're just sitting there, it's smoke filled, little Japanese highball is chilling. It is beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's horrible for you.
It's horrible.
But it's like, there's something about that. You're taken back to that era.
Yeah.
It's going to be dead in, you know, 20 years or whatever.
Well, I think we're having a comeback, a smoking comeback. Anyway, it's interesting because
they just got to figure out what is, because it's not nicotine that causes the cancer. They got to figure out what it's, the tar and other things.
Well, it's the tar and you're burning. Yeah. It's just the smoke.
It's carcinogen.
But the
we'll figure that out with AI.
They'll fix cigarettes. But you know, I'm in Nagasaki. I pick this place. It looks like a smoking place. I go there. I'm alone. I'm the only customer.
Yeah.
I sit down and I go, you know, I order a coffee and I go, oh hey, can I have an ashtray? And I'm like, oh, it's not smoking. And I go, oh. I was like, I actually, like 80%, not, you know, I'm sure everything is great. 80% of the reason I picked this place is because I thought it was smoking. And I'm at the end of the counter, bar counter. And the guy just kind of looks at me. And he reaches under the counter. And he pulls out this beautiful glass ashtray, puts it out of the counter, and just slides it down.
No way.
Wordlessly. And then he comes around, and he sits across the counter from me, and he puts his cigarettes down. And we smoke together. It was just this beautiful, like he's like,
he's like, all right, you're in. Yeah.
And we talked for 2 hours, you know, and he was this incredible, like, impresario of Nagasaki and just had this amazing history. So it's just funny how a little vice like that, for me, used to be mindful and in these, like, social moments, is really powerful.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I'm pro-cigarette. Unfortunately.
Well, I mean, hey, one a day, it's like, you know, you're eating healthy Japanese food the rest of the time, you're going to be okay.
if you're having a couple drinks a night and eating a bunch of sugar, I mean, like, that's killing you just as quickly.
Oh, absolutely. Well, we're going to get kicked out here in a minute from the hotel, but I want to say thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Excited for your book to come out.
Thank you.
Where can people, like, let's just pretend, you know, obviously there's going to be some that a lot of people have heard of you, but if you're new to your whole world, where do they start? Do they sign up for your newsletter?
Just sign up, craigmont.com. And then there's Roden newsletter and Ridgeline newsletter. Mm-hmm. And you can, on the homepage of craigmont.com, there's an email sign up that lets you sign up for both. Just sign up for both. Ridgeline is walking related, and Roden is just general. I'm writing about like film and literature and whatever, life, like kind of random essays kind of go into that one. Just sign up for those two.
Awesome.
And you'll get everything. And then you'll find out about everything else.
Awesome.
But, you know, my website, I have 20 years of essay history on my website, and, you know, it's all there.
That's fantastic.
Kind of fun.
Craig, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.